happens in the next couple of days, the next week. It'll be interesting to see what kind of things pop up.
Well, I think tomorrow's vote, or it could come to a vote tomorrow, the liquor store, the throwing away of 5,000 jobs, just completely pitching it, and that's tomorrow.
Oh, but they'll find jobs, Pat. Come on. The private sector will bring them in gainful employment. I mean, you know, from the very beginning of this latest assault on the asset known as the wine and spirit shops in Pennsylvania, from the very beginning, the Corbett administration, Terzai, all of the Republicans who keep pushing this like some fetish. I mean, it's the privatization fetish that these guys have. Every step of the way, it's been one lie, one fabrication, one myth after another. And when you finally break down the lie, the fabrication, the myth, they come up with another one. You know, I remember right when this all started, right at the very beginning, we were one of the first programs on the air to be talking about it, saying, look, they're going to come for this asset, they're going to take it away, and they're going to hand it over to their campaign buddies. What they tell us? Oh, we're going to get $2 billion. Almost immediately, Pat, almost immediately, the $2 million number was debunked. No one, not even the Tinky Tank over at the Commonwealth Foundation, not even they could justify where they pulled the $2 billion number out of. I have an idea where they pulled it out of.
I was going to say, probably it smelled bad. Nobody really wanted to get too close to it.
So immediately they jump off the $2 billion number. Then they go, well, we can justify $1.7 billion. And after a couple of months, well, you know, maybe not so much. And then it was $1.5 billion. And then it was $1 billion. Then it was $500 million. And you go, well, wait a second. We get $500 million a year from it every year. Why would I want to sell it? Why do I want to sell the Golden Goose?
For a one-time amount of $500 million.
Exactly.
Because so, their buddies will make that money from now on.
Well, I mean, that's the underlying theme in all this. But it's the lies, it's the fabrications, it's all of the BS they keep throwing at us. And then when all of the money numbers were debunked, it wasn't about the money anymore. It was about core function of government. And I love this one because, you know, government shouldn't be in the business of liquor sales. And I go, well, I'm going to be honest. I think, having grown up in a state where beer was everywhere, where you could get 42-proof liquor literally everywhere, yeah, I think government should have a role.
You know, I don't really care about sins. I don't care about sin regulation. I'm a libertarian when it comes to that stuff. I think it all ought to be legalized, prostitution, everything. And then we can regulate it and have some control over people, whether or not they're making other people sick. Yeah, but when it gets to...
Let me stop you there then. So then regulate it, because that's where I'm at. So you say you're a pretty big libertarian. Let's open it up. But regulate it? Explain that a little.
Well, what I'm saying, well, that was prostitution. If we legalized prostitution, then we would have women being checked and they'd be tested for illnesses. But in the case of this, it's just throwing money away. Money
yep.
that we're going to have to raise taxes to replace.
Oh, we're not going to raise taxes.
Yeah, we're just going to...
We're going to cut funding for education.
What is it? We're going to make a government so small that we can drown it in the bathtub? No, it's ridiculous. It is necessary to pay for certain things that an adequate and responsible government made up of the people should be delivering. We're riding on a road right now, driving down a road. The roads need to be there. The roads have lovely little reflectors on them. They need to be there. The bridge is, you know, a tanker blows up and burns up a bridge and somebody's got to replace it. And there are things that the government is uniquely suited to, and it has to be paid for.
And that's what the Republicans are saying. Let's sell the liquor stores and get whatever pennies we can get for it, and we'll put it in the roads.
Yeah, no, that's idiotic, because what you're doing is you're giving up. What is that thing? What they're talking about is trading the cow for the six little beanstalk beans. You know, here's the cow. We got milk for a lifetime, but no, we're going to take these six little beans and plant them in the magic privatization garden, and everything will be okay. Because then it's a great big beanstalk, and we go up there and we get the goose that laid the golden egg from the privatization garden. It's just absolutely stupid. And the thing is, the thing that drives me nuts is, why aren't the voters keyed into this?
Well, I think it's all of the misinformation. I mean, I've talked to numerous people who've said, well, you know, if we can get $2 billion for it, that sounds like a pretty good idea. And then you explain to them, well, that's only 4 years worth of what we're bringing in if we just leave it the hell alone.
Yeah. Well, but still, why don't they get that? I mean, it doesn't make any sense to me. Why would I, look at it as a business. Why would I give up my means of income? Why would I do that? That doesn't make any sense. It might make sense if I were terminally ill, and that's really what they're hoping. They're hoping government is terminally ill, and they can be done with government. And by the way, never vote for someone who doesn't believe in the job you're electing them to. If someone says, I'm going to get rid of government, and then they want to be put in the government,
Run. Don't
vote for them. Yeah, run. Run yourself. Run for office.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it would be like me going, I've got a brain tumor, and I'm going to go to a doctor who doesn't believe in knives.
Yeah.
I'm going to go to a doctor who doesn't believe in surgery. I'm sorry.
Or any
medicine.
Other procedure, right?
We're going to put our hand on your head, and we'll see if that helps.
A little faith healing. That's what this is about. A little government healing.
There's a lot to that. I mean, it's this whole blind faith belief in this mythical free market. And you talked about the jobs there for a second. 5,000 good-paying, family-sustaining, community-sustaining jobs will be eviscerated, will be gone, wiped out. And where will those people go? Oh, the private sector will get them jobs, the right tells us. Well, that's completely false, because we know where liquor will end up. It's going to end up on the Walmart shelves. It's going to end up on just another product, an impulse item next to the Tic Tacs.
I got to tell you, I come from a state where Walmart sells booze. And just like everything else Walmart sells, it's crap. So on top of the fact that, you're going to have it all over the Walmart, you're going to have boxed wine and the cheapest beer you ever saw, Coors crap.
But Pat, I'm told that the free market will bring me more choices at better prices.
Oh, no, I'm telling you, I shudder when the only place you can shop is Walmart for alcohol. So you're having a dinner party, and you're like, oh, my God, I forgot to get some. And you walk into Walmart, which I don't do because they sell crap. They don't even have bottled wine. They have boxed wine, and every watery, icky beer that they sell. And those are your choices. You don't get... I mean, I love the Pennsylvania liquor stores. You don't drink. I drink. And
I drink occasionally.
Well, I love going into the Pennsylvania liquor stores because there's somebody there who knows what... I mean, I'll go in and say, I'm making a piece of fish, and I really want something that's going to not be, too overpowering. And, and they make recommendations, too. They know if you're buying a bottle of wine, you know whether or not it's going to be gross, And you have a wide array of prices to choose from, and they have boxed wine.
So you're saying the guy standing behind the counter at the local drug mart or the local drug world isn't going to be able to give you those well-informed, highly educated choices there? Not going to happen?
The pharmacist at Rite Aid in Maine does not help you select your beverage. Believe it or not, they do your pharmaceuticals. You're on your own when you go into Rite Aid on whether or not you're going to get Coors Light or Miller Lite.
See, I would think that the people who are in charge of the pharmaceuticals would be perfectly suited for the alcohol.
Then maybe they are, but guess what? They're not allowed to, because they're busy doing your pharmaceuticals. They're busy making sure that you don't get the wrong medicine and drop dead, which is the role of a drugstore, by the way.
See, but here's my problem with all this, and we've spent a couple of minutes talking about the rational, sane, logical reasons why this is a bad idea. And for me, it comes down to we have spent now 2 entire years talking about this. 2 entire legislative sessions, we've been focused on this, the shiny thing, the thing that really, I don't know anybody who thinks and any normal person, any person who works for a living, who has to get to work on the crummy roads, has to get to try and find a job when they're not there. I don't know that this is a problem for 9/10 of the people in our state. What it tells me is all of this focus, all of this effort, all of this push to steal this asset tells me that they've got nothing else to do.
No, that's not what it tells you. What it tells you is there's a cash cow called the liquor industry, and right now the state of Pennsylvania is in control of who gets the cash out of the cow, and about 10 friends of highly placed legislators and the governor want the cash cow. It's not that we don't have anything else to do. It's that, you know, there's a beautiful woman in the high school, and you asked her out, and she turned you down, and you asked her out again, and she turned you down. Guess what? You're coming back to school in September, you're asking her out again. Can't learn your lesson because you're absolutely convinced you have to have her. It's pathetic.
On a certain level, given your scenario, I give someone credit for at least trying, because, you know, maybe you got a shot, and maybe it's going to be good
for
somebody.
That's what they're thinking. You know
what? This is no good for us. It's no good for anybody.
But you're going to wear the voter down, and you're going to wear the legislators down. You're going to wear them down, and you're going to keep asking, and finally you're going to say, oh, well, what could be wrong with it? They've been after us for 5 years now. Let's just let them have it.
But here's my problem with this. And, you know, maybe I misstated it a second ago. Isn't there anything else that needs to be done in our state? Aren't there any bridges, any roads? Isn't there aren't there any projects that we could be focused on that would improve the lives of people instead of, well, ripping us off?
Oh, yeah.
And why aren't we doing them? And why aren't people screaming in the streets that things aren't getting done? Is it that we've just gotten beaten down and we've gotten to the point where people just throw up their hands, they're not going to do anything anyway?
I honest to God don't know. First of all, I don't know why people vote the way they vote. I don't know why Governor Corbett's governor. I don't know why 5 Republican legislators ran unopposed last time. I don't know. And then I don't understand. I mean, obviously they've got their dogma. They've got their talking points, and their talking points say, screw the poor. Screw the people with their hand out. Yeah, and, you know, it doesn't even matter that the people they're talking about, for the most part, are children. You know, I mean...
Well, they don't vote.
No, they don't vote, any one of these guys, they see a tin can on the side of a Sheetz counter with some little kid's face on it, and he has a brain tumor. Oh, yeah, they'll dig deep down and they'll get that extra $1.37. All that $1.37 will go right in that can because they're such good people who care so much about children. But sick children, healthy children, all of them who've got poor parents, screw them, you know? And so I don't understand. I don't understand. And so the greed, all I can think of is when we were in Arkansas, and I watched that video about the kids that went to Central High School, and one of the black kids, the 9 black kids that was, you know, they had to force the school to let these black kids in. One of the 9 kids says it's easier to organize hatred. It's easier to organize hatred than it is to organize love. It's easier to organize someone to say no than it is someone to say, sure, let's give it a try.
It's always easier to be against something, but couldn't you make that argument against selling the wine and spirit shop? Wouldn't you? You know, you're just against it because it's your ideology. You know, you're not willing to try.
My ideology is bring in money into the state and do good things.
But we've devised a scheme where it's potentially possible under every perfect scenario that we would make at least the same amount, if not a penny more.
Thank you, Michelle Bachman. You know. Honest to God, I don't know why we have to be stupid just because we don't know that somebody else has already been stupid.
Washington State.
Right. Just look to other states. Michelle Bachman, we don't need a minimum wage. Let's give that a try. Why don't you just visit Haiti? They're giving it a try right now, and you can see what it looks like. You know, I mean, it's not like Pennsylvania is going to be the first state to privatize alcohol. And as I said, I drink alcoholic beverages. I lived for many years in the state of Maine, where you could go and purchase alcoholic beverages anywhere, anytime.
Nope. Well,
except midnight until 8 a.m. on Sunday morning. Other than that, any place, anytime.
Wow.
24 hours a day, if a place was open, you could buy alcohol.
See, when I was in Cleveland, you used to be able to go through, they had these drive-through set up. I don't know if they had them in Maine, but they had these barns, like the one in Carlisle, that you could drive through and you could pick up. But you used to be able to buy a single can of cold beer. They'd pull it right out of the refrigerator for you, give you a single can. And it's sometimes, I think they'd even open it for you.
That's the way it is in Florida. Yeah, well, I mean, and as long as it's for a passenger in your car, right? You're all set.
What if you're driving by yourself?
Yeah.
I guess that's one of those, stop touching me!
But that's the other thing, is it's not illegal to drink and drive. It's illegal to drink too much and drive. And so that's the other slippery slope that people get on, is then after they've had a beer or two, they have to make the decision what's too much.
I think they do have open container laws where you can't have an open container in Pennsylvania.
Well, then I guess that will eliminate someone driving through and having an open container handed to them.
But they do sell those. They do sell those cute little can holder things.
The koozies?
Yes.
I bought a couple of koozies.
I know you did while we were in West.
In West, yeah. Pray for West, it said on it, and I had to have those.
But, you know, I look at this, and I look at the whole budget fight and all of the what's going on in Harrisburg. And I just, you know, as we're out here on the road and, you know, we're exploring and discovering the history of workers across the country, you know, I just had to take some time and look back because, you know, I saw they want any transportation bill money. And now the governor has come up with, well, in his State of the State speech, said $1.8 billion over the next 5 years. On a need that even his transportation commission said is far exceeds that number. Senate Republicans want $2.5 billion a year for the next couple of years. House Republicans are saying, well, we're not doing anything until you get rid of that prevailing wage and you steal wages from those people who are doing the work. And I look at this and I go, when will the rational part of the Republican Party expel the Daryl Metcalfs and the Stephen Blooms and the other radicals that are inhibiting the House GOP?
I don't think they're going to. And I think that's something that the average voter needs to start getting their hands around. Why the United States wants a two-party system, I'll never understand. But why they want the two parties to be the Democrats and Republicans, I find even more remarkable. You know, I mean, just jettison the Republican Party. And a
good portion of the Democratic Party.
Well, no, because then the Democrats will be the Republican Party. Because they're so conservative right now. Democrats are Republicans.
Okay, there you go.
Okay, Republicans are fascists.
The president himself, over Christmas, said 20 years ago he'd have been a Republican. So I see your point.
Yeah. So, and the rank-and-file Republicans, they're not the fascists. It's their leadership. So they can all become Democrats because the Democrats are Republicans. And then let's find a party of the left. Let's find a progressive, intelligent party. I happen to have one that I'm rather fond of. But let's find an right now, the Socialist Party is launching a letter-writing campaign to have student loan debt forgiven. Okay, that's something a political party should be doing. By the way, it's something a political party in power should be doing. But these two conservative political parties we have aren't going to do that. So we've got a third party launching a letter-writing campaign. You can go to their website on Facebook. You can check it out. You don't have to become a member of the Socialist Party to write a letter to your congressman. In fact, you should write a letter to your congressman every week, whether you need it or not. You know, if the only place you have to think is the bathroom, write it on toilet paper.
That'd be a good thing.
Yeah, send it to your congressman.
Should you use it first or not?
I would say no.
Okay.
I would say no. But write to your congressman and say, you want to stimulate the economy? Take the anvil off of children's necks, young people's necks. Let them have what they should have had all along, which is a decent education that didn't bankrupt them. You know? And just do it. And it's brilliant. I mean, the way it's done now is they bankrupt children, young people, even if they can find a job, they can't afford to pay their student loans. But because of the income tax deduction, We'll just suck all their money out of them anyway. They'll garnish their refund every year
for life. And yeah, I gotta find a gig like that. I gotta find a money making venture where I've got the keys to the kingdom, and the only way you get through that door is by paying me. And if you don't pay me, I will have someone hound you till the day you die.
Sounds like you want to privatize liquor.
Ooh, there you go. Let's take a quick break. When we come back, I want to talk a little bit more about the transportation piece of the budget. Also, some of the other insanity our governor has put forth. Not even setting up an exchange, but he's already saying what the exchanges will and will not have. Quick break, right back from the road. The People's Tour for America. Stick around, we're right back.
Exposing that free trade is never free. The Rick Smith Show.
We took a concerted effort to go out and find women who had backgrounds that could be qualified to become members of our cabinet. I went to a number of women's groups and said, can you help us find folks? And they brought us whole binders full of women.
Binders, Pat. Binders full of women.
You
were up in Massachusetts for a while. Were you in one of those binders by any chance?
Oh, man. I remember Mitt Romney getting elected. That was crazy. You know, and he was left of Obama by a lot when he was a Republican governor from Massachusetts.
That.
Oh, yeah.
What happened to Mittens? I mean...
What happened to Mittens is the same thing that happened to John McCain. You've got to get the stink of a... I kind of smell a skunk right now, actually, while we're driving. But you got to get the stink of these neocons all over you. They won't support you for...
We are in Arizona.
Maybe it's not a skunk.
Maybe not.
Maybe it's just the governor.
Maybe.
What's her name?
Jan Brewer.
Yeah, see? That's it. Smelling some Brewer.
Ooh.
All right, so anyway... You've got to embrace the rabid neocon, or you don't get, you know, what you need to run for office. So that's pretty straightforward and direct and simple. And so Mitt Romney, first of all, I don't think it was that big a stretch for him to think of the other guys as the takers and himself as the maker. I mean, that's why he did Bain Capital. You know, that's why he destroyed businesses and sucked the money out of them.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's the ultimate vampirism. You've got to kill the host. You suck on the host until the host dies. And, you know, move on to a new host. And so that's what he did at Bain Capital, and now it's pretty much what he does in...
Back to it.
Yeah.
But you know, here's the thing. I saw this story the other day that the governor signed a piece of legislation stating that Pennsylvania would, in whatever private plans that come up, will no longer be allowed to cover abortion services. And I'm going, well, wait a second. We don't have the exchange set up. We haven't done really anything to get ready for the Affordable Care Act. In fact, he's done everything he can possibly do to obstruct, delay, destroy, whatever. But now he's making it that even in the things he hasn't had any hand in, well, we're gonna deny women this coverage, even if it's a completely private plan from a private company to a private citizen. What happened to the Republican Party?
Well, they have become the party of the uterus. And, you know, I'm kind of relieved that the uterus finally is important. You know, this is my note on my guitar that I play all the time. The rules of the Republican Party, every relationship must have at least one, but no more than one uterus. And The contents of the uterus is important to the government. And you're not allowed to do anything to stop something from forming in your uterus. So birth control's out. But then once you have something in your uterus, it basically belongs to the government until such time that it's born, in which case...
We don't give a damn about it.
May it draw a breath and die. You know, so... I find it interesting, though. See, as everybody knows, Pennsylvania is one of the states that is not going to select the exchanges. So in another non-Republican thing, non-traditional Republican thing, they're going to allow the federal government to come into Pennsylvania and select the exchanges for us.
Which I'm actually happy about.
Well, you may be because you want them selected well, but nobody in Pennsylvania should be happy about it. No Republican, because they've lost local control. Now, Republican Party used to be the party of local control. Pick the exchanges. You'd be able to say what insurance companies you're going to do business and at what price inside the state of Pennsylvania, but now no. So because the government will be selecting the exchanges, Governor Corbett would like the state of Pennsylvania to pass a law that says no health care purchased, no health insurance purchased through these government exchanges, even if it's a private company that was doing business prior to becoming one of the exchanges, may provide abortion services. Now, it's really fascinating because they will allow you to have private abortion services if you buy it from a company that's not in one of the exchanges.
Well, that's swell.
So it has nothing to do with the life of whether it's a child or not. It has nothing to do with whether or not the fetus thrives. It has to do with whether or not it's an insurance company that's playing ball with the Obama administration. So if you purchase it from an insurance company that's not involved with an exchange, you can get abortion services. How's that? Spectacular.
You can turn your head.
You
can just look the other way.
Look the other way, why? Am I going to have to cough?
Don't you remember our governor with the transvaginal ultrasounds and the ultrasounds? You could just look the other way. Just, you don't have to watch.
Watch? How about feel? What an idiot. He's crazy. And by the way, what is even more amazing about this whole thing is that you're not going to be able to get abortion services in your plan. You will be able to get it if it's a plan that's not involved in any of the exchanges. But you can still get abortion services in the case of rape and incest. So even the exchange plans allow it for the case of rape and incest, which again is hypocritical because... Are you claiming this is a human being or aren't you?
Yeah, I mean, that's one of those things where, you know, I do have respect for some people who are pro-life because they're pro-life. No bombing people, no executions, no death penalty. They're pro-life across the spectrum.
And of the mother. I got to keep throwing that in there. They're capable of making a decision about which life gets saved. Well, so that's not pro-life.
But I respect somebody who's taken the position that they're pro-life, and it's across the board. There are very few of those people, though.
It's anti-choice across the board because the life of the mother's involved, and that life can be snuffed out. So I'm just taking exception with your taking exception or whatever you're... Because when they say they are pro-life, they need to be able to say... Every mother's life will be saved, and they are unwilling to say that. Like that young woman in Honduras or wherever who just died because they wouldn't allow her to get her chemotherapy because she was pregnant. You know, that's not pro-life. It's anti-choice. And if you're anti-choice and you're anti-choice across the board, I'm with you then. Nobody gets a choice. Nobody. I say no, nobody, me. I'm the only one with a choice, me the voter, not you the person with the baby. Then, at least if you're consistent. But this, yes, it's okay for rape, and no, it's what is that?
No. But at the end of it, you know, again, I go back to the, you know, my view on the whole abortion thing, which, because I'm not in favor of it. I'll never have one. I hope my kids never are in that position. I believe in education. I believe in prevention. And the sad reality is we've done very little to prevent that from happening.
You know where the abortion rates are the lowest?
I would guess somewhere like Massachusetts.
Where birth control is free.
And I would guess the places where it's highest are places where Sarah Palin and the rest of them put their head in the sand and talk about abstinence only.
The number one subset of women who get abortions are Catholic women.
Yeah, I can see that.
Yeah.
Having grown up Catholic, I can absolutely see that.
So they find themselves, they didn't use birth control, they find themselves in a bind, they have to elect for an abortion. And so all that said, though, give away free birth control.
I'm right there with you. But again, our governor, I think, again, on the wrong side of, which is why I think 2014, him out, so important. Going to take a quick break, right back, stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, From the Road, the People's Tour for America. Stick around.
Intelligent conversation with a heart. The voice of the working class. Rick Smith. For a change. The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to the People's Tour for America. You can check out the website, thepeoplestourforamerica.com. Follow us across the country. See where we're going. You can also see where we've been. Lots of photos, some videos, a lot of audio, the people that we've talked to, the lessons we've learned, the things we've discovered. Also, my daughter's blog, you can take a look at her writings, the lessons that she's learning. And really, that's, to me, as a parent, the focus of this. You know, as a radio personality, as doing this program, I want to bring back the knowledge that we find and talk about history, but also from the parental side of it. My daughter needs to know what 100 years ago she'd be doing. Chances are, as she's finding out, she'd be working in the looms, my son working in the mines. That's our history. You know, and as we move through the Southwest into Arizona, I thought, well, you know what? Let's get a preview before we get into Arizona. What are we looking for? I mean, it's beautiful country down here. I know Arizona, the birthplace of Cesar Chavez, born somewhere near Yuma. But what else don't we know, which is why we've asked Rebecca Friend, Executive Director, Secretary Treasurer of the Arizona AFL-CIO, to talk with us. Rebecca, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you for having me.
You know, when I proposed this tour and we laid it out to our listeners, said this is where we're going and this is why we think it's important, a lot of people were saying, you know, the South, the Southwest, why? There's no labor history there. Those are right-to-work states. And I'm going, there's worker history everywhere.
I agree. I think there is worker history everywhere. Arizona has a pretty rich history of labor going back all the way to the turn of the century and the copper mines. Arizona used to be a state that was focused primarily on copper mining, cattle, and climate. We used to be the five C's, and cotton and citrus. So those were the five C's that the industries rallied around here, and it wasn't until the late 70s, early 80s, that we saw this big growth boom and other industries come in. But the copper mines in particular have a long history here and probably one of the most eventful labor events in the country was the copper miners' strike and the governor at the time, Governor Babbitt, calling in the National Guard to break the strike.
Boy, that seems to be a common theme. You know, most places we go, you know, you talk about it, that seems to be a common theme just about everywhere.
And that actually broke... put a serious dent in the unions, in the mining unions that were here, and allowed one of the largest copper mining companies in the world, Phelps Dodge, to break a contract. And it certainly changed not only the landscape of those areas in Arizona, but the political landscape, but the economic landscape. Most of those towns that were once thriving metropolises, not only for the union members and their families, but the secondary bump you get from businesses and industries around, and has pretty much devastated those towns and was a turning point in Arizona labor.
Yeah,
certainly one of the largest turning points. Earlier in the 1800s, to break a mining strike, they actually went in the middle of the night, the sheriffs and local authorities, and loaded the miners onto railroad cars and shipped them back to Mexico, and then dropped them off in the middle of Mexico to break a strike. So
yeah,
there's a lot of those kind of incidents that have happened over the years that were pretty monumental for Arizona and for the Southwest also.
Yeah, and listening to those stories, because there are so many of those stories where you've got these big corporations, and, you know, Arizona, that you automatically think of Phelps Dodge, you know, especially with the strikes in the 1980s as well. And, you know, you look back at this and you go, have things changed? I mean, because you see, you know, right now, all of this talk about, you know, being more business friendly, and we need to have business friendly rules and, you know, let business be. It seems to me, you know, we're doing almost the same thing without the real outward, you know, rounding up of citizens and imprisoning them and shipping them away. I mean, we're doing it with people here in an undocumented fashion at an alarming rate. But for most people, I don't know that they're seeing that.
Yeah, I, you know, the tactics are different, certainly. They don't come and round you up in the middle of the night. They just close, right? They close, ship it overseas, do, you know, tiered benefit plans that reduce benefits for people coming into these companies that are represented by unions. So they have different methods, but it's the same messenger, so to speak, or the same message, which is, you know, to break the unions. The climate currently is, you know, the recession hit Arizona really hard because as we shifted with this enormous growth, we became a state where tourism and new homes were the primary industry. Well, once the growth dropped off and the recession hit, both of those industries took a hard hit.
Right.
So we're still recovering from the recession, and we're certainly experiencing the same thing that my union brothers and sisters are experiencing across the board, which is a decline in union membership based on jobs being shipped overseas, companies closing, or hostile company negotiations.
Yeah, and, you know, in this austerity talk, you know, this push by Republicans and a couple of Democrats, not many, but mostly Republicans pushing this idea of slashing funding and gutting education and gutting spending on infrastructure, that just seems to be making, you know, those things much, much worse.
It is making it much, much worse. And in Arizona, because we are, as a lot of people have seen on late night television, the testing lab for ALEC and other institutions that want to destroy the middle class, we have a lot of legislative things that have happened in the past few years that have really taken our public education system to a new low. We just have a new study that we're one of the lowest in the country per pupil spending. So our educational system is under attack, and charter schools are on the rise here.
Yeah.
I think we're also one of the largest states for charter schools per pupil. So we're seeing a lot of that. We're seeing a lot of ALEC model legislation almost verbatim passed here because both of our houses are controlled by the Republicans. And, of course, we have a very famous governor here who likes to shake her finger in the face of the president.
Yeah. Are you sure you're not from Pennsylvania? Because, you know, it's a Republican control, a governor who's, you know, a kind of nuts. You kind of got to go, sounds the same, charter schools, defunding education. And I'm sure, I guess, and I don't know, and you'll correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm sure your governor's got to be giving, like ours in Pennsylvania is, hundreds of millions of dollars to corporate special interests in the hopes that they'll bestow, you know, their benevolence upon us.
Absolutely, and we have an interesting thing going on right now. It's been going on for a couple of years. One of the largest projects that is here that the building trades have gotten work on is the Intel plant here. And they had a luncheon a year ago, and the head of Intel was sitting with the governor at a luncheon and told the governor if he had known when they were planning what this state was going to look like as far as education, its hostile environment, the craziness of it, he would not have asked that the plant be built here. So while they're trying to court businesses, the businesses that they're courting and bringing in are call centers. We are rapidly becoming a call center state also. I expect in the next 5 years we'll be somewhere in the upper five states that have the amount of call centers we have.
Yeah, and I look at that, and you know, you've got states that are leading the race to the bottom, and our governor in Pennsylvania, he wants Pennsylvania to be one of them, because the same thing that you're talking about, defunding education. And, you know, I know people who their job is plant location. And they tell me that, you know, low tax rates, that's not really something they look at. The laxest regulations, that's not really something they look at. What they look at is location, 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 top three, then education and infrastructure. And our governor, you know, he in Pennsylvania, knows he's got a pretty decent location, but he's gutting our education, and our infrastructure is crumbling right before our very eyes.
Well, you know, it's interesting you said that. I agree. I think large companies look for those things, sustainability for their employees, but they also are now looking at, because we've had a couple of companies reach out to us, at the diversity. You know, the diversity of the population. And, of course, you know, Arizona, through its government, is doing everything it can to reduce diversity in the state of Arizona. But that's also one of the criteria a lot of the large companies are looking for.
Let me ask you this, Rebecca. You know, because, you know, one of the things that has caught my attention in doing this tour, and, you know, I think about, you know, the ability, and I use the Jay Gould quote, and I use it quite often. I could easily pay half the working class to kill the other half. And maybe we're not paying they're not paying us to kill each other, but they are using us, pitting us against one another. We are a sliced and diced, divided working class, you know, white collar, blue collar, union, non-union, white, black, green, whatever. They use those things to keep us pitted against one another. And to me, the immigration issue is another one of those things, central to pitting groups of workers against one another. And I think Arizona's been that one of those places where that's been kind of the hotbed issue.
I think it's, you're exactly right. I think it's the perfect example of pitting one group of people against another people to repress both groups. You have the workers here, the undocumented workers, who are brought in to be paid lower wages and to be disposable, for lack of a better term, when the employer gets tired of them, and to provide no health care and no safety conditions. And then you've now created a frenzy of everything that's wrong in this country and in the state is due to this group of people, not the employers or the corporations who are taking advantage of them, at the same time suppressing wages on the union side based on that they can get it done at this cheaper rate by using undocumented workers. And so you've pitted people who are trying to come here to do the very same thing that at some point in all of our lives, or I should say most of our lives, outside of our indigenous people, came here to do the very same thing. So you've pitted two groups of people who really need to be together in order to be strong against one another, and it's been a very effective tactic.
Oh, absolutely.
And at the same time, the corporations are still bringing in undocumented workers to pay them at lower wages and abuse them and you know, injure them on the job and then ship them back to wherever the undocumented worker came from.
So what you're saying is, and I know you're right, but just to highlight the fact that you're saying the corporations are bringing the people here.
Absolutely. I mean, there, you know, the Republicans love to talk about supply and demand, right? If you have no demand, you have no supply. Workers aren't coming here because someone has told them this is a great place to be, to tromp across the desert at 114 degrees and pay a coyote thousands of dollars for them to leave you stranded in the desert, right? We have an unprecedented number of deaths from that activity taking place every day in the southern part of our state. They're coming here because they believe there are jobs here, and they believe they've been told there are jobs here. So if you look at this whole cycle of immigration, that's why immigrants are coming. No one volunteers or chooses to leave their family and their home and everything they've known just on a whim. Or maybe some do, but the majority want to make a better life for their families or for whoever they love or care about. So they come here because they believe there are job opportunities here. If there were no job opportunities, there would be less immigration.
And I'm sure as, you know, as the executive director there of the AFL-CIO and the secretary treasurer, I'm sure you get these stories often from these people coming across. Cause, you know, I think about it from my perspective. Look, I look at our trade agreements that have just been horrible. And I point out often that NAFTA, when Mexico had signed NAFTA, they actually had to change their constitution that stole land away from the communities that they used for farming because it was, well, it was an unfair trade barrier.
I think Arizona, again, is a perfect example of that. The city of Nogales is both on the United States side and the Mexico side. If you look at the city of Nogales, and it's separated by a river, if you look at the city of Nogales on the Arizona side, it's a relatively small city, you know, has some industry, pretty decent place to live. You cross the river and go into the Nogales, Mexico side, you will see all these American companies who have moved right across the river and are paying substandard wages, working people in unsafe conditions, no health benefits, and you have this 1 million-plus population that's just pushing at this border, right, because they've come from Central America or Central Mexico up to these factories to work at these substandard jobs.
You know, and the thing is, you know, you look at that and you go, wow, that's just them over there. We need the cheap goods. And I don't think a lot of people put it together that if we allow those conditions to happen, those are going to be our conditions very soon.
Well, and I had this discussion the other day and I asked somebody, is it worth a dollar less for a pair of pants if you know that it's a woman that may be underage, maybe have a child, working in a substandard factory for 50 cents an hour and no health benefits and the safety conditions are questionable? What is the value we place on that? And these are American companies. This is not Bangladesh. I don't have to turn on CNN to see these kind of conditions. I have them less than 2.5 hours from my office.
Yeah, you know, and I look at this, and you brought up Bangladesh. We were out, back some time ago, flyering the local Macy's and the Target, telling people, hey, 1,127 workers went to work one day, and the building that they worked in collapsed on them because, well, the employer decided, I need an extra couple of floors added on to the building, and, well, there are no regulations. We don't have to worry about that. And you're nothing, all for a couple of pennies. And I asked the same question. Would you be willing to spend 10, 15, 20 cents more? And I guess I wasn't surprised. Virtually everyone said, absolutely, but we're not given the option. And I think
that's
the problem.
We saw that here in 2006 when we ran the minimum wage initiative to raise the minimum wage because we were not seeing the federal government be responsive. You know, the threat was, particularly from what I call fast food restaurants or chain restaurants, was they'd have to raise prices, and overwhelmingly, people voted for the minimum wage initiative and passed it with an increase that occurs every year based on the CPI. But they passed it because they didn't mind paying a few pennies more to ensure that the person serving you is not having to go to the state for their health care because they can't afford health care or can't live, you know, without any assistance from the government because of the wages they're making while they're working 40 hours a week. So we asked that question, and clearly the citizens of Arizona said, no, that's the right thing to do, and our minimum wage right now is actually a little bit higher than the federal.
Yes, it should be. And, you know, on the minimum wage front, I mean, what we've allowed to happen is we've allowed corporations to lobby government to set up their models based on, you know, subsidizing their businesses because they're paying crummy wages with no benefits, and people need those things.
Right. I agree. And, you know, right now I know people look at Arizona and we hear all the jokes and, you know, I can tell you that what you're seeing is not representative of the people of Arizona. It is representative of the government of Arizona, and the government right now is controlled by some extremists, but it is not representative of the people or the union members in Arizona and their feelings about, just their fellow citizens and how, you know, what kind of a life and what kind of environment they want for their children and their future. So it's a different view from here on the ground than it is from the Bill Maher show, even though I love him. It is a different view here.
So let me ask you, last line of questioning, as we move through your state, what do you want us to see? What should we take away from our visit to Arizona?
I think your visit to Arizona should be one of beauty first. It is a beautiful state.
Absolutely.
You know, we have you know, we have some of the greatest scenery and diversity of geography, which hardly anybody knows that either. You know, you can go from high mountains, you can go from high mountains and snow to the desert in 2 hours. It's a beautiful state. I think the people here are good people. I think you should take away that there is a union movement here, and it's alive, and it's you know, we have our good days and our bad days, but we're still here, and we're growing in certain segments, and we're striving to be relevant and stay on top of the politics here and change the government here so that it truly reflects the workers of Arizona, unionized and non-unionized. So as you go through, I hope you get a chance to talk to some Arizonans about what they really think about the things that are going on here and how they really feel.
Yeah, we will make
and not just the ugly.
Well, we will. I mean, we're going to talk to gas station attendants because we're going to need gas. We're going to talk to waitresses and waiters, and we're going to talk to people all across the state as we go through. And I really appreciate the time, Rebecca. Thank you so much.
Not a problem. Thank you very much for having me.
Rebecca Friend, Executive Director, Secretary, Treasurer of the Arizona AFL-CIO. Quick break as we continue on the People's Tour for America. Remember, you can follow us, thepeoplestourforamerica.com. Quick break, right back with the Rick Smith Show. Stick around.
Waving the flag of freedom for people, not corporations. Rick Smith.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickSmithShow.com. If you've missed any of the program, therickSmithShow.com, that's where you get the podcast, or any of our coverage of the People's Tour for America. It's all right there. You can see where we've been, where we're going, who we've spoken to, all that right there at the website, therickSmithShow.com, or People's Tour ForAmerica.com. You can also interact with the program. You can email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. You can like us on Facebook, follow us, Twitter, all of that right there at the website. We are on the road in Arizona, the beautiful sunny state of Arizona, 101 years old. And, you know, you go back and you look at a little bit of the history. 1917, you had the Brisbane occurrence where they rounded up a bunch of those other people and marched them right out of town.
Yeah, I mean, I think most people don't know anything about this story. And that's because nobody teaches it in school. You don't learn anything about it. But we are going to spend a little bit of time researching and bringing you what we've learned about the history of Arizona. But Arizona's rich, very rich in natural resources, and most of those natural resources have to be mined. And, you know, strip mining is the way of everything now, is surface mines. But back in the day, they needed really well-trained miners to go down into mines and get out the copper or whatever the ore was that they wanted. And, you know, Native Americans were living on the land out here when this part of the country was being settled. And they didn't pull the natural resources out of the land and rip it, you know, rip the ore out. So this area had to import that kind of labor, had to import the skilled labor. And Slavic nations and Mexico and other places had these skilled workers. And these workers had guilds. And they worked together to do this kind of work. And they had apprenticeships. And so they brought these skilled workers in. And, well, once they trained the Westerners, the white folk, how to do the jobs, no need to keep them.
March so you them round out. Them up, march them out.
Right.
And, you know, you look at this and you go, how much different is it? How much different is it now? I mean, we're still rounding people up. Maybe the skill level's a little bit different, the skill set's a little different, but we're still rounding people up and shipping them out.
Well, I mean, no matter what kind of work you need done, certainly the Hilton family is proof of the fact that they'll bring in a whole pile of undocumented workers and put them to work cleaning your toilet, and then you'll get mad at someone who got you a clean toilet and want them shipped back. None of that makes sense to me. First of all, Why aren't the Hiltons in jail?
Because we've got pathetically weak labor laws.
I interviewed Sheriff Joe Arpaio last winter, and he told me that he had made 46,000 illegal arrests of illegals, alleged undocumented workers. And I asked him, how many of their... I said, where did you arrest them? He goes, we arrest most of them at work. And I said, well, how many employers did you arrest? I mean, if you're arresting them at work, right?
Exactly.
You know who the offending employers are. 46,000 arrests. How many employers did you arrest?
Three. How many?
Three.
Three?
Three.
Wow. That seems high to me. I was how many, I guess, how many did they put in those little pink underwear in the tents out in the desert?
Yeah, none. I'm certain of it. I'm willing to bet none. He didn't answer that. I didn't ask it. But, no. And the thing about the 46,000 is, he didn't say we convicted 46,000. He said we arrested. And up until last month when the United States Supreme Court said that he couldn't do it anymore, he was pulling people over just because they looked Mexican.
Well, we need people on chain gangs.
Italian people that looked Mexican.
Ah, yeah.
You know, no matter what the ethnicity, if they looked like they were a little bit brown, that was enough probable cause.
Here's the question I have.
Melanin pigment in your skin was probable cause.
I get that. But I've been in Arizona and New Mexico for the last couple of days, and I got to be honest with you, I'm darkening up.
You know what? You are a white boy, and you look like a white boy. So I don't think you got anything to worry about.
All right.
And that's,
well,
the bottom line.
Because
I don't have
all my
about.
Papers with me.
But you know what? If you did looked brown and you got pulled over, you'd be let go in 30 seconds because it's obvious you aren't. And that's the thing. That's why it sucks so bad for these people. Because they've got an accent or... I mean, my father spoke French as a child. He wasn't from France. He wasn't even from Canada. But his family spoke French. My grandfather spoke French. My great-grandparent... That was the first language they learned. They're all born in the United States.
My daughter wants to learn French.
I know. That'll be wonderful. Both of my kids are fluent in French. But they had to go learn it because my father was so sick of being stigmatized for having a different language that he didn't speak it to us. You know, we're absurd about this stuff.
Yeah. But, you know, as we're going across Arizona, and look, you know, when we sat down, we did some of our precursor research, you know, I found out there's not a lot of written labor history in this state. But, you know, as we're going to find out, an awful lot of history.
Right. And, you know, there are unions and organizations in Arizona that have files. They have insurance files. They have, you know, all the different membership information. And for the most part, that's been sitting in damp, lousy, nasty basements in other places. And so we're going to talk to a woman who... Master's degree at Simmons, which is probably, if not the best, one of the top five library sciences schools in the country, gets her master's degree at Simmons and wants to archive what the different labor unions have saved for documentation about workers. And I'm like, wow, you mean this is going to end up preserved? Like, no more rats eating through it, no more acid paper dissolving. It's going to be preserved and protected at a university. What a wonderful thing to have happen.
Absolutely.
Arizona State University hired this young woman and put her to work preserving the documentation of labor history.
And, you know, I've been wanting to see this happen. You know, just a couple of days ago we talked to Karen Jones, the Teamsters archivist, who, you know, the Teamsters have decided that, hey, we need to archive our history. And I've been saying for the longest time, I'm waiting for that to happen, because the sad reality is the right wing in this country has done such a masterful job of writing labor's history. And it's about time that labor tell its own story.
Well, and if they have their way, if that masterful group has their way, they will eliminate labor history. Just like the kids in China don't learn a darn thing about what happened in Tiananmen Square. History's written by the winners, and if they can expunge the story, the good news is there are still a whole pile more labor members and a whole pile more people who want to have a decent place to work. Those kids from Walmart we were interviewing before we left.
Yeah.
Kids who were taking their jobs and running the risk of losing them. And I got news for you, Walmart. Your job sucks so bad, it's not that big a risk. It's a shame, and it would be awful, and these guys have to pay their rent. But it's not like you're doing anything for anybody. You know, Walmart employees use food stamps. Walmart employees are on public health. Walmart employees have got to go to the government for all kinds of things because they're just plain not paid well enough. Walmart employees live in homeless shelters. That means the American taxpayer is subsidizing Walmart to underpay their workers.
Well, that sounds like the American way. That's a good business model, Pat. What better way to run a business than, you know, externalize your cost?
I know. But those are the people who need to be organized. And maybe if we get labor history back where it belongs, which is on the top of people's minds. You know, nobody goes looking for a labor union who's got, you know, great pay, excellent benefits, everything they could ever possibly want, some decent vacation time, and a retirement plan. You know, if people want to be certain that there aren't any labor unions, then, okay, Walmart, take the average paycheck and times it by six. Give them the same health benefits that the Walton family have, and a little vacation time and some retirement, and you won't have to worry about it.
Well, you know, the thing that gets me, you know, as we're going across the state and we're learning this stuff, is that there is a movement to try and do some of that, but there needs to be so much more. Going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk a little bit about the archivist and what's going on here in Arizona. From the road, the People's Tour for America. Stick around. We're right back.
Just right. The Rick Smith Show.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. The People's Tour for America is rolling through Tempe, Arizona. Today we stopped at Arizona State University here in Tempe. Labor history, Pat. You know, when we announced this tour, I got a number of people saying, hey, why are you going to places like New Mexico? Why are you going to places like Arizona to talk about labor history? There's none of that here.
You think everybody thinks everything happened in Lowell, Massachusetts. You know, there were a couple of shoe strikes. That was the end of it. Quite frankly, nobody works anywhere, but no, there's a lot going on, and I am so excited about this particular interview, both of these interviews that are upcoming, because I have for a long time felt as though we are the most selfish, self-centered white, for want of a better word. I got mine. My immigrants were a couple of generations ago, so all the people of color that have come here for work are worthless. And I'm so sick of that attitude in the United States of America, and I'm just so excited that we're going to set to right the fact that every time Rush Limbaugh complains about a strawberry picker, remember, that guy hasn't missed too many meals. He doesn't look like he's pushed away too many strawberry shortcakes, does he? And I hope he just picks his own from now on if he doesn't like the way it's gotten.
Well,
anyway.
We're here in the library with Javier Flores. She is the project archivist, and the project's labor rights are civil rights. Javier, thanks for taking time for us.
Oh, thank you for coming all the way to Arizona.
Did I pronounce your name wrong?
No, it's Javier Flores.
Okay,
yes.
I just wanted to make sure.
Thank you.
Because it just popped into my head. I go, that, just for a second, I thought I had it wrong. You know, I've had a number of people tell me that, you know, there's really no labor history here. And in my studying of it, you know, there are a couple of things that pop out, but there's got to be so much more than Bisbane, the deportation in 1917, and the Phelps-Dodge strikes. There's obviously much more than that.
There's a lot of history here, which is one of the main reasons why we fought for the grant, to get the grant. Because there is that mentality that all the scholarship that you can do or study or the, all the history that really happened with, like, labor is in California, or history that has to do with Mexican-Americans is in California or in Texas. And, well, we study the history here, or at least the people who put together the grant are the ones that have either they live in Arizona, they know the history, they know that there's a lot that just isn't known and isn't studied. In fact, we had a graduate student who was in Arizona. She had to pay her way to do her research in Arizona, even though she was studying in California, because even her professors were like, why are you doing your dissertation on history and, you know, Mexican-Americans in Arizona and labor in Arizona? There's nothing there. And she's like, actually, I grew up there and there's a lot of history. And they just... it just doesn't get studied. And so that was one of the great things with achieving the grant, is that we were, our objective really is to show that there is a lot.
Okay. We just got to back up a little bit. Okay. You're an archivist.
Yeah.
And you're not our first archivist on this trip. You're not our first archivist.
Okay.
We were with an archivist for the George Bush Library, which I got to tell you was a treat. And so you're a librarian. You do the really well, right? But it's very important to have jobs like yours, because you're the people who do these collections. So a collection, I just want to set the background about what you're talking about. A collection was donated to you, and it was paid for by this grant you keep mentioning. And so tell us a little about that thing that was donated to you, and then maybe who funded it.
So the grant is to organize these six collections, which the university has actually had many of these, a lot of them since the 80s. But the problem is getting funding to organize them. And these collections have been people before me going out into the communities saying, hey, what you're doing is important, and we want to document it. And so it's basically what's been collected. It's going to individuals, either going to the organization or to individuals in the organizations and saying, we want what you have, or we want to be able to preserve it. So there's a place that people can come study it and use it, and also letting them know, too, that it's not that we're taking it away from them, but we want it to be in a place where we're the one, I mean, the archivists are skilled in making sure the documents
get preserved.
So, like, what the AFL-CIO collection that we have, which is Arizona's AFL-CIO collection, they were in some storage area, basement, that there were rats, obviously rat droppings, bugs, eating away through this material. Oh, there was another collection that we have of the six called the Alianza Hispanoamericana, which was the first mutual aid society for Mexican Americans in the state of Arizona, and really in this region, and it was kind of a way for Mexican Americans to organize, since they weren't allowed to be part of other societies and get life insurance or health insurance or anything like that.
Wait a minute, they weren't allowed?
They weren't allowed into the other organizations. So it's like, how do they get it? So
why weren't they allowed? What was the difference between them and the other?
They were brown. They were Mexicans. So
they were Mexican nationals, or were they just Mexican of Mexican descent?
A lot of them were both. The nice thing about the Alianza Hispanoamericana is they represented both Mexicans and Mexican Americans. While there were other organizations that were only for Mexicans or only for Mexican Americans, because you also had you have Mexican Americans who they want to show that, yeah, we're ready to assimilate and be Americans. And
assimilate so, like the Borg?
Like,
not a Star Trek fan?
Oh.
I mean, did they have to give up their identity for this assimilation?
For example, with the League of United Latin American Citizens, they stopped doing, they did all their meetings and conferencings and conferences together in English only. They made sure that people, they were trying to kind of push away from their old culture and really kind of adopt this new culture. For a lot of it, they were pushing out Mexican nationals. It was only for Mexican Americans. If you're a Mexican national or Mexican American that only spoke Spanish, you were kind of left out in some organizations.
No, there are an awful lot of Americans that think that's a good thing. You know, if they don't come, if they get here and they don't learn our language, then let them. And I lived in a foreign country with a foreign language, and I tried every day to get by, and it's exhausting on top of everything else where you're just, and I was trying. I wasn't being disrespectful. I was trying to speak their language. I wasn't coming up to speed as fast as maybe nobody treated me poorly, but I mean, really, there's an attitude that if they don't learn English, then.
Well, like, that's the worst misconception, too, because a lot of people who, any immigrant that comes here really wants to, they came here for opportunities. And it's like, wow, if I really want to get a job, what do I need to do? What are the skills that I need? They're really trying. You know, they really want to be successful here. That's why they came here. So that's always frustrating, too. And also another thing, not for being from Arizona, I didn't grow up here, is, too, is that, you know, they don't want to teach any Mexican history. And it's like, well, Arizona was Mexico. Arizona's history is Mexican history. American history is Mexican history.
Well, it's the same thing. They don't want to teach workers' history. And,
yeah.
You know, what I find interesting about what you said about the archives and the conditions they were in, is, you know, the groups that you were talking about, their thinking is fighting for today, not trying to preserve what happened yesterday. They're worried about the here and now, I think, a little bit more than the past. And what I find interesting about what you're doing here with the archive, as this project archive is of the project Labor Rights, Our Civil Rights, is, you know, across this country, there's a move to get rid of and erase all of labor's history and all of worker history throughout the country. A number of these labor education centers have been defunded and destroyed. So I find it encouraging that you guys here at Arizona State University are going the other way and trying to preserve that history.
Yeah. Well, so with the Alianza collection, actually most of it's in Spanish. And one of the reasons why it was rotting in some storage areas because no one wanted to touch it because it was in Spanish. And here we are. We're not only want to make it accessible in English, like AFL-CIO is in English, United Steelworkers of America, those are mostly in English. But we want to preserve these ones that are in Spanish as well because it also tells the history. We can't deny that that the history here is of both cultures, both countries, and both languages.
It's kind of disheartening to think that everybody's more than happy to know Columbus's history, and that one was written in Spanish. And that's the one where, you know, here, have an infected blanket.
Yeah. Also, for me, it was shocking that I was told I was one of the first Spanish-speaking archivists or of Spanish background. So I was like, no one, you guys have never hired like an archivist or a librarian that's wanted to translate these before. Maybe it's because with libraries, there just aren't the resources. But we made... So really my goal with the project is, well, it needs to be done. We have to do it. So it was one of the first collections that we processed, and by that, cleaned it up, organized it, thinking about how people were going to use it. And they're really great collections because they also show a lot of immigration history. A lot of it are membership files. You have birth certificates. That one specifically is more with the life insurance, health insurance.
You know, it's interesting because we were talking about this actually last night on the road. When George Bush got done on the top of the rubble that was the World Trade Center, he handed the bullhorn he used to someone so it would be saved for the archives. I mean, all the time they're thinking, I'm going to go out there and make sure that I'm not forgotten. I'm going to make sure that I'm remembered for the things that I'm so. But when you think about, and this was what we were talking about last night, so it's wonderful that you're here. Where's the average person's archivist? You know, where's the average person collecting those things? And here you are.
Well, and it's shocking. We go out into the communities, and they're kind of just like, who are you? What? Not only what you do. I mean, a lot of people don't know what archivists do. But kind of shocked that we're interested. And we're like, yeah. Like, I mean, right now we're even involved with some of the, with the DREAM Act Coalition because that's something really important that we want to document in the state.
And that is?
The DREAM Act Coalition is for, it helps support undocumented students find resources, their rights, education in the state. I think like 80% of the students eligible for DREAM Act rights live in Arizona. I mean, it's ridiculous.
So these are children that were brought to the United States by undocumented workers, and so they themselves are undocumented, but they're students in the...
Correct. You know, they come to the university level. They want to be productive members of society, and they want higher education, but they don't qualify for in-state tuition.
Do they have Social Security numbers?
I don't know if they've resolved that issue yet.
I don't believe that.
I don't think so.
So how do they get even through the process of applying?
I have no idea. I've always been really curious about that myself. But a lot of them are still out there in demonstrations, showing their faces, really just passionate and willing to fight for what are really human rights. So.
Because at the end of the day, the whole issue of undocumented workers is that we need to pull them out of the closets and out of the shadows. Because as we allow them to be exploited and underpaid and all of that stuff, it pulls everyone down.
Yeah, well,
and
you'll have to...
It's more of that division.
You'll have to unring the bell that Arnold Schwarzenegger was ringing left and right in California. I mean, you know, there has been such a legacy, especially of people who got it, like Schwarzenegger, who, by the way, is not a U.S. citizen, or is now, but was an immigrant who had to be, you know...
Yeah, but he got the special fast track.
Yeah, he got the... I'm so big, my muscles will hurt you. Let me in thing. But
is that how he got in?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. He's like, oh, Maria, you are so hot. Let me become a Kennedy. Presto changeo.
Exactly. And then let me go after the housekeeper?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Is that how that works?
Yeah, there just are not enough Arnold children in the world.
Wow.
Well, that brings me to one of our collections, which is the Maricopa County Organizing Project, which try to resolve that issue, that really we need to show support for the undocumented workers so that they can also, if we kind of help them with what their needs, then we can also get somewhere with the needs of our own domestic workers.
Now, I was a new mom a couple of months ago. And I was talking to the housing folks who help homeless people at UMOM because it's one of the largest, most fabulous homeless shelters in the country. I think it's probably the best. And there are people who go there who won't even come out of their room because they're so afraid of Arpaio and his vigilantes. And in Maricopa County, how do you get from a culture where, you know, finally, the Supreme Court a couple of weeks, maybe a month ago, said, by the way, Sheriff Joe Arpaio is wrong. In the meantime, he told me personally he's made 46,000 arrests of brown people, 3 arrests of employers.
And on the side of the road, we saw people pulled over.
Yeah.
You know.
So how do you get people to come forward to you to discuss this when there's that kind of arrest ratio? I mean, that's what I said to him. Why don't you arrest the employers? Yeah. Arrest the employers. And so how do you get people to come forward and tell you this stuff when the boogeyman is just waiting around the corner?
That's a really interesting question. You know, I think from what I've seen, because I think I'm more, the only people I really associate with are the ones that are willing to come out kind of the shadows. Is throughout the whole history that they've really kind of been persecuted out here, is that they end up dividing between themselves. And so you really do have those Mexican nationals, Mexican Americans, those that are kind of fine with the status quo. I mean, you see with the recall for Arpaio how it was unsuccessful. And everyone, maybe it's because, you know, I work on a university campus. We're all in shock. Like, how is that possible? Like,
because he's tough on crime. Tough on crime.
He's going to keep us safe.
Yeah.
Just like the Bush Museum.
Oh.
Yeah, just like the savior there. If you get a chance, go to the Bush Museum.
Bring a barf bag.
The greatest president in the history of this nation. By far, hands down.
Gosh.
At least that's what he tells us.
I was nothing but fight or flight through the whole thing. You know, it was like total carnal. The basis.
He kept us safe.
It was horrific.
Except for that one day with all the twisted metal.
It was horrific. It is horrific. And but that's the thing is we've got this. If it's not for initiatives like what's going on here, history will be rewritten and the truth will be forgotten if it has not already to a large degree.
Which is why we thought of doing this tour, going across the country and finding the stories and finding these situations of workers' history that we don't know. But I think need to be preserved and talked about.
Well, when you look at the workers' history, they're divided because, you know, they see the undocumented workers who, you know, they were Mexican, but now they're documented. They don't like their neighbors anymore because...
So there's that divide.
There's a huge divide with that.
So they're actually pitting Mexican workers against them based on status.
Yeah, there's a huge history there of even they would... they would form these groups that would stand along the border and stop Mexican-Americans, and people who used to be Mexican
maybe family
nationals,
members.
They would stand on the border and they would stop undocumented workers. They would work with Border Patrol, almost as if like...
They're Minutemen.
They themselves, because they saw the threat to their job and them living in the state.
That's the other thing Arpaio told me was he said, look, I'm just opening up jobs for the ones that are supposed to be here. I'm not saying they all have to be white people. And that's the other thing. I mean, to me, a Hispanic individual is not a different race. So, you know, I have a real problem with that white versus, you know, first of all, we're all the same. But anyway, that's what he was saying.
Think.
Yeah. But that's what he's saying. He's saying I'm making it easier for the good ones. I'm getting rid of the bad ones so the good ones can work.
Yeah. Well, you also have the divide in that some people don't like being they don't identify as Hispanics. They don't no longer identify as Mexican American. They're Chicano, or even people who are from South America immigrant workers from even further south into South America or Central America and South America. They're Latinos. We self-divide already.
We put ourselves in the little subcategories that are easily pitted against one another. And you go back to the old labor saying, and I say it all the time because it's true. As Jay Gould said, I could easily pay half the working class to kill the other half.
Yeah.
And it's painfully apparent in every subcategory and subdivision and all of that along the way.
And here in Arizona, where a lot of the labor history is a lot of the civil rights history, then it's not only the divide within our own group, but then us conflicting with other groups. When they say, when city officials say, oh, well, anyone who's not white can have South Phoenix. Well, then we're all fighting over South Phoenix. So
walk me back through that again.
That's like a neighborhood, right? South Phoenix is a neighborhood. So it's like, you know, saying the Italians can have the north end of Boston.
Oh, okay. So like when I was a kid, you had Little
Italy
and
Slavic
Village.
Yeah, it's like the Portuguese. Yeah.
Okay.
It's like, neighborhood.
Yeah.
Providence.
And there's a history there in the 40s that I think Chris is a little bit more knowledgeable about.
And when we talk to her, maybe we'll get a little bit of that.
You'll get more historical in-depth there.
So, you know, with the last couple minutes we have here on this, you know, this archive, you know, who's going to be able to access this when you're done? How long do you expect it to take? You know, where do you see it going?
So I'm actually only here until the end of the month, which is when the project ends, which we hope to have all of them accessible online. And by that, I mean, not to be confused with, what we do is you end up forming a guide, an index. It has some historical context, lets you know what's inside the collection, and then a list of everything. And then you can request to see certain folders, certain boxes, certain objects, and then...
Will it be digitized and put online?
It won't be digitized. That's actually something really hard in our profession that costs a lot of money and labor.
Because that's why I think it's important that the Teamsters, who are, you know, we just found out that they're having all of their archives put out at George Washington University. It's all being digitized.
That's fantastic.
So that you can go and you can see that history of the Teamsters Union. And I wish that were accessible, you know, on a number of, you know, like what you're doing in a number of the archives.
I think with that, they'll do it slowly. We just started a digital repository where they're starting to put materials up there, And already they're working on some film that has to do with, like, farm workers.
Because as I was researching, you know, every area we were going through, we did some research before leaving, because you'd like to know what you're talking about when you get into a new area.
Yeah.
And, you know, finding information,
yeah,
virtually nothing. If I wanted anything from the Heritage Foundation or the American Enterprise Institute, boy, they've got tons of stuff on history.
All of it wrong.
All of it wrong. But, you know, the story that's being told is being told by the...
Yeah, that's something that I really worked on. So I guess maybe being a child from the social media age when I'm born, I'm really big on Facebook, Twitter. We did a blog for the grant, just figuring out... looking at all the outlets possible that we could
share the
information. So it's not already on our local websites and, like, state websites, but trying to get it through that. Because also we get a lot of our information on Facebook because so many – we've met a lot of Latinos are really active on Facebook. And that's – we found that's kind of our niche with outreaching to them.
Well, that's where the Arab Spring came from, too. I mean, literally, people networked on the Internet and hung out in Tiananmen. They all Facebooked each other and said, hey, meet me downtown.
Yeah.
In front of the McDonald's.
Which is why we
right
need
there.
To get rid of the Internet.
So, which is why, another reason why I was at the labor conference where I met Pat. And I've also gone to a conference in South America because I wanted to know how collections were organized there, how the profession exists there, because I want to make it accessible to to researchers who are studying labor in other countries, Spanish-speaking countries, to let them know, well, you can see our stuff, too. You can see the labor, Mexican-American labor history here, and we have it in Spanish, so it's accessible to you as well.
What happens to you in a month?
The grant ends, and I will be heading back to Boston to see my fate there. So.
See my fate? Is that what you're...
Yeah, to figure out my fate there, but I, you know...
Back to Simmons?
So, not back to Simmons. I'm back into the figuring out my work field. But I think definitely working here has opened up my eyes that I do want to continue working with civil rights collections, hopefully labor collections, human rights collections. That's something especially also a huge issue that crosses over, well, the border. You'll find that they're starting to document a lot. There's a lot of humane border societies trying to help people that are crossing over. And they're working to document that history down there. So all these topics I think I'm I really, really hope I can continue doing.
Well, we hope you do, because it's something that needs to be done.
And you're such a go-getter. I mean, literally, she came up to me and said, we've got something in Arizona you want to come and see. Yeah. And that was great.
Yeah, and we're thankful for it, and we appreciate you taking time for us.
Oh, thank you so much for coming. I appreciate it, too.
It was great talking to you, Javier Flores. She is a project archivist, and labor rights are civil rights, the project. Quick break, right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
For this reason, that I must tell those who fail to report for duty this morning, they are in violation of the law, and if they do not report for work within 48 hours, they have forfeited their jobs and will be terminated.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. You know, I still remember that August in 1981 when Reagan fired the Patco workers. And, you know, a lot of people think, you know, this was a one isolated incident. The reality is, as I've said in the past, Pat, that was the shot heard across the boardroom. That was open season on workers across the country. And as you saw in the years that followed, 81, 82, 83, you saw a lot of employers start to take a much harder stance and really pushing
strikes, pushing for strikes, locking workers out so that, well, they could break the unions and, well, get us to where we are today, where, you know what, no voice.
You've got to admit that firing air traffic controllers was the most brilliant thing possible. You know, that is when you've got thousands of planes in the air, the people you think have to be the most skilled, best multitaskers ever are worthless. You know, worthless. They want to make a decent wage, and we've got tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of people flying through the air, and we could just eliminate them. We can just eliminate them and buy a man who doesn't care how many lives are lost by those people in the air.
And the thing that gets me is, you know, as history has gone, the right has spun it. Well, they were just greedy. They were making a lot of money, and they wanted more money. And anyone who really knows what happened during that time period, it wasn't about money. It was about more about safety. It was about staffing. It was about antiquated systems. It was about a whole bunch of things that had nothing to do with money or benefits, had everything to do about job conditions, had everything to do about safety. And, you know, the thing that gets me is when you go back and you read the history of that, Patco actually endorsed Reagan because Reagan said that he was with them when it came to all of the demands and all of the wants for safety and staffing. He was with them when he was candidate Reagan, but when he became President Reagan, well, he saw that that is an opportunity. Well, the payback is his corporate buddies.
I think that this comes back to that part again where you've got to be more circumspect and you've got to be, you know, I've run for office a bunch of times, and when people sit there and pay lip service to a union to get the union endorsement, walk away with it, and then, you know, I'm no Albert Einstein. I can tell that's a lie. I can tell that's a lie.
Yeah.
You know, and it's not even that they lied this time. It's that they're telling the same lie they told last time.
They don't even have to be creative and come up with a new one.
Yeah. And the thing but their leadership is still falling for the lie. Really? Did anyone really think Ronald Reagan was going to care about a union?
But, you know, the thing is he was a former union president.
But he was also the former governor of California. And he had a heck of a track record. And that's all they had to do was read it.
True. You know, and you look at that, and you look at the years that followed. You know, you had the coal strike, you had the Pittston coal strike. You had Phelps Dodge in Arizona, where we are now, which really changed once those victories were in the pockets of the businesses, of the corporations, and the workers got basically slaughtered. It was open season across the board. Once those big iconic names went down, well, then it was, well, everybody else.
Yeah, I mean that is what they do. They take down the big guys, and then it's the whole house of cards. Couple of support beams are gone and nothing's going to stay standing.
And, you know, I go back to that whole period where, you know, it blows my mind that you have so many people who turned into, believe they were these Reagan Democrats who turned into the Republicans who then turned into the neocons and the Tea Party. And, you know, I look at it and it's really the moneyed interests who have led a good portion of this country around by the nose.
I think I think when you've got enough desperate people, you can lead them by whatever body part you can get a hold of.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, that's some of what we're learning from visiting Arizona State University and speaking to the women who are collecting the labor history data is it was real easy to break certain unions because there were so many people waiting in the wings out of work. You know,
yeah, I guess, you know,
an empty belly's got no conscience.
Yeah, you know, you look at it and I go back to the Clinton years. For me, one of the reasons I voted for him is he said that, here again, back to the politician, he said he would push for strike replacement. And if it weren't for the two Democrats from Arkansas, oddly enough, and Bob Dole,
there would be strike replacement in this, a strike replacement bill in this country that says, you know what, if I go out on strike, you can't scab and take my job. The employer has to absolutely sit down and negotiate and bargain and come to it as some sort of agreement. That isn't the law of the land. And what happens when you get desperate times like we have now and you have more people looking for jobs? Last number I saw was 3.5 people looking for jobs for every one job that's out there. So when you have that kind of an environment, what you end up with is this race to the bottom. Because if someone's going to stand up and say, hey, we'd like to have better wages, hours, conditions, well, the employer said, no. What's your recourse? Because I know there's 3.5 people behind you who are just dying to take your job.
And they are. And then what your employer then is going to do is give your job to all three of them. So they each have a third of a job.
Exactly.
And then it gets even worse.
So the more I look at this stuff and the more we learn and the more we talk to people, what do you see as the direction we need to be going? And I know in the last segment we talked to the woman who's archiving the history of Arizona's labor movement. You know, the idea that you were able to pit the Mexican workers against the Anglo workers, and you know, in the South, the blacks and the whites, in other places, men and women. Where do you see this in what we've learned so far? Where do you see this going in the coming years?
Well, I think that we have to marry the labor movement and the environmental movement. I think that they're natural allies, and they have a few differences right now. Some of them seem kind of large, but that's unfortunate because if those two movements, which consist of a lot of people, 19 million people in the United States, their jobs dependent on labor unions, and I dare say at least 20 million, you know, real hardcore environmentalists. If we could get those two organizations, those two like-minded groups of individuals to work together. We were on a train today, and the train conductor said, talking about the Colorado River cutting the Grand Canyon. And he was talking about, you know, it's only took 6 million years to make the Grand Canyon, which is amazing. He's talking about that, and he said, but you're going to have to imagine a Colorado River without dams all up and down it. And you're going to have to imagine a Colorado River without them siphoning off the water supply for towns along the river. He said, that Colorado River, which built Baja California, that whole peninsula that runs down beside Mexico,
right,
doesn't even make it out of the United States anymore. And I've been there. I've been to where it stops, where the Colorado River ends. It doesn't make it to the ocean anymore. And he said, now this guy, I don't think, I didn't ask him, but I'm willing to bet $1,000 that he would not call himself a liberal.
Oh, no, by no stretch of the imagination.
He said, doesn't that sound crazy that they let them dam that river and siphon the water off? It's a crime that they let that happen. This guy said it. I mean, conservative and conservation, they've got almost all the same letters. You know, and it's time for those people to join forces. And I think the labor unions, if they could join forces with the people who care about the environment, I think then they'd be a formidable force.
I know the steelworkers have done an awful good job of it with their Blue-Green Alliance, trying to do exactly what you're talking about. Because there are natural alliances. There are opportunities for both communities to move forward. And you're right, there are a handful of situations that have divided. But again, that's one of those things that the wealth class does masterfully.
Yeah.
They throw that wrench into the system just to cause that chaos to keep people at each other's throats.
They've gotten a couple of topics where labor seems to be like, okay, we need those jobs even if they're bad for the planet. And it's not really bad for the planet. It's bad for the humans because the planet will still be here. We're going to go away. But, you know, if we were really investing in alternative energy, we wouldn't need those jobs at all. We'd have near maximum employment. If we were making the turbines that are on the...
You see that Texas wind farm?
Yeah.
Wow.
And what did you
miles,
say?
Miles.
Tens of miles, I'm willing to bet.
And if I remember correctly, and I'm going to go back and look this up when we get back to the studio...
if I remember the story right, they were made in China.
Right. So if we had those manufacturing jobs here. Also, I've heard that the carbon blades are almost all made in Germany. So why aren't we making them here? We've got closed shipyards. Retool those shipyards. Start manufacturing the alternative energy. We won't have to talk about bad power that's bad for the planet. We won't have to talk about power that's going to, you know, poison your water supply. We won't have to do that. We won't have to talk about jobs connected to poison. We'll be able to talk about jobs connected to sustainability, growth. And did you see they just, in Dubai, they've got a city now, zero footprint. The whole city, zero carbon footprint.
Well, I'm hoping as we move out to the West Coast, I'm hoping once we hit Oakland, we'll be able to see the IBEW's training facility, which is, as I understand it, net zero. They produce all of their own energy.
This is a whole city.
But I'm just saying, you know, for the U.S., that's a step in the right direction. Look,
it's the totally right direction, yeah. And I'm not surprised it's a labor union.
And you're right. I mean, you go back and you look at the people who are out in front of this, and the electrical workers, the IBEW, have been out on the front of this because, you know, that's their jobs, and their leadership sees that as that's the opportunity for the future. Why can't we get policy makers to think that way? I mean, I go back to the Recovery Act, and one of the, you know, when I still thought Obama had a really good shot of being a great president, there was a ton of investment in alternative energy. Not nearly as much as I would have liked to have seen, but there was some. I put solar panels on my house because of it.
Well, and anyone who sends their kids to Carlisle High School sees it. That was Recovery Act money.
Exactly. So how do you get to that point to where, you know, hey, we want to be the Dubai? And, you know, I guess that's the question for future days. And while we're on the tour, the People's Tour for America, and of course, if you've missed any portion of our tour, therickSmithShow.com or PeoplesTourForAmerica.com. It's all right there, where we've been, who we've spoken to, where we're going. And in the coming days, we're going to be in Las Vegas, we're going to be in Los Angeles, and then up to San Jose for Netroots Nation, all of which we'll bring you as we then continue up the coast to Portland and then back the direction towards home, which I am having an absolute ball on this trip, Pat, and looking forward to each new day.
I know, I am too. It's exciting, it's fun. But I got to tell you something. Today made me tired.
Yeah.
I don't know if it was 7,000 feet and thin oxygen and running around like crazy, but whew, today's the first day I can say I'm really tired.
It was so tiresome. The kids got right into bed. No fussing, no complaining. In fact, two of them asked to go to bed.
How crazy is that?
That's tired. Gonna take a quick break, right back with hour three. Stick around, you're listening to the Rick Smith Show. We're working people, come to talk.
Uncovering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith. Sanity for a change. The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to the People's Tour for America. Find out where we've been, where we're going. You can go to the website, peoplestourforamerica.com. Interact with the program there. You can like us on Facebook, follow us Twitter, and also follow us where we go. They're at the site, all of the cities right there. Today we're in Tempe, Arizona. I'm sitting here with Chris Marin. She's a historian, a curator emeritus of the Chicana Research Collection at Arizona State University's archives. Chris, thanks for taking time for us.
Certainly, and I always want to make the correction of the pronunciation of my last name. It's M-A-R-I-N, Marine. Or in Spanish, Marin.
Okay.
Just thought I'd clear that up.
I am well known as someone who butchers names.
It's something that I do often throughout my entire life, so it's just a habit.
As someone with a name Smith, very rarely does anyone mispronounce it, so I rarely have to fix that. Maybe that's a problem I have.
My name is so simple that it's a little difficult.
Well, it's something that I always do, and it's just a habit.
Well,
so
thank you
don't be
that.
Offended.
No, nothing's offensive to me. I just want to make sure that I have it right.
All right.
But thanks for taking time for
sure.
us. You know, when we started this tour, you know, a lot of people were asking, you know, why Arizona? What's there? And, you know, as we spoke earlier, there's an awful lot of labor history in this state.
Arizona today, modern Arizona in 2013, still has very much the presence of labor unionism in thought and action and word and deed and research. And that, of course, is a rich history for those of us who were born and raised in Arizona, like me. Very young age, we learn in Arizona history the five C's: copper, cattle, climate, citrus, and, of course, cotton. These are the industries that supposedly built the state of Arizona. And looking at these industries today, we can think of others. Like I have formulated in my own little thought, M's. What are the M's that have built Arizona? Missionaries, Mormons, Mexicans, militants, Mofford, Mecum, and so forth. So if we look at those names of former governors, or if we look at those names of groups, then we try and understand a little bit of the history of the state. Of course, statehood occurred in 1912, but we go back further if we look at labor and that whole concept of working class workers building unions and coming forth to think about the importance of equal pay.
Right, but hold on.
When Governor Mecum, of course, we've got to say real quick.
I think
Governor
Wild
Mecum.
West.
Yeah.
I think individual. I think, you know, I don't think unions. I don't think collective anything.
That's because Arizona sometimes, in terms of the research one does regarding the history of the state, in Arizona, labor unions may not have always been given the fair shake in interpretation of state history. It takes a labor union researcher, writer, historian to write about unionism. If we look at where we are today in Maricopa County, the word labor or the word union sometimes is associated with the terrible words whenever there's a strike: thug, union busters, troublemakers, militants, socialists, communists. Throughout state history, those are words that have been associated with those who attempt to fight for equal pay, a fair wage, safe working conditions, fair bargaining at the bargaining table for a fair contract. So you always have this division in the state of Arizona: pro-labor, anti-labor, pro-union, anti-union. And I'm just talking about labor unionism. It doesn't matter what the trade, what the industry, but that's the history of Arizona as well. So we can be in Arizona, but it depends on where you are when you mention those words,
right?
Unionism or labor rights or unions or strikes. People will tell you what those words mean to them depending on where they are and what their experience has been.
I don't think that's just Arizona. I think that's across the country. I mean, you look at Pennsylvania, and in the cities, unions are,
exactly,
are viewed as something very positive. I grew up in a housing project on the west side of Cleveland, and to me growing up, a union job meant a shot at a middle-class,
sure,
existence.
Sure.
Meant getting out of poverty.
Well, when we look at the state of Arizona, statehood 1912, there really has been a whole table full of history that talks about Mexicano workers or Mexican immigrants who were also trade unionists in Mexico, learning the trade of unionizing, bringing together workers to strike, if you want to use that word, for fair wages, as an example. They learn the trade. They learn how to become miners, as an example, silver mining, copper mining, gold mining. They learn all of that. And then they have those skills, and they're brought in by engachadores or contractors, for example, in the early history of copper mining to become the miners in those areas. But they end up training Anglos, and then the Anglos get the fair pay or the better wage or the better housing. There's no racism because they're the ones who are in control. They're the ones who are being taught those skills by the Mexican worker. That began very early in the early 1900s, way before statehood as well.
Yeah, it's interesting you say that because, you know, as you're reading through this history and I'm learning this stuff, so, you know, as you're telling it, you've got the people with the experience who come in. They train, you know, the Anglo miners to do the job. And then, you know, just a few years later in 1917, they end up rounding them up and bussing them out of town.
Well, you had that whole era of World War One, where copper is very much an important resource and very much needed for the war effort. So anyone coming in to agitate workers is looked upon in a negative way, a socialist who is not an American, if you want to use that word, someone who is against the United States war effort. So anyone who comes in to agitate workers, whether it's a strike or whether it's for something that's very simple, right away the word comes out that you're a socialist or you're un-American or that you're anti-USA. And so therefore, if you want to mention a union, you belong to a union, you're part of the labor industry, as in the example of Phelps Dodge and Bisbee in that period of time in 1917, those who belonged to the union were deported, if you want to use that word. That's an interesting term.
Only union members were deported?
Union sympathizers, those who belonged to the union, yes. Those who were pro-international, IWW, International Workers of the World, those who were looking to help the Mexicano worker. And I should say that there were other workers besides Anglo workers, Mexican-American workers, or Mexican workers in that group that were deported. There were also the Italians. There were also some Slavics. There were also others. So it isn't just the deportation of Bisbee that involved Anglo workers. It involved many other groups as well.
Now, it's interesting to me. I mean, no matter what the time frame, it's the same story over and over, the same history we're reliving, and I see a lot of the same themes come around, the same, almost the same thing as 1917 mm-hmm. we're talking about doing today.
Well, whenever people come together and want to be paid a fair wage, there's that competitive, there's a competition, that thought of competing for a fair wage that comes into play among workers who will work for a fair wage and workers who will not support workers who will work for less. And that's the whole history of the working class in the state of Arizona or anywhere. You have those who favor unions, who fight for fair wages for their members. Then you have those who are anti-union because they're fighting for fair wage. Then there are those who will hire workers who will work for a less pay. And if you're working for in an industry, as in copper, for example, it's just a business. You want to make more money, and so you're going to pay a worker whatever wage you desire to pay a worker who will work for less. And again, you have that whole play.
So if you can create desperation conditions, you can exploit those desperations.
Sure.
So when you have a great collapse like we had in 2008, there's an opportunity, you know, to pit people against each other in more desperate situations.
It's always
wages.
That. It's always that. And that's why you have those who hate persons or workers who will work for less money than what you think you should be paid, a fair wage. And copper industry.
In looking at this, and you go back to some of the strikes I've been reading about, the people who cross the picket line, do they get that they're actually making conditions worse for everybody and not just for...
They're just looking at the job, and they're looking at the pay. Maybe they're out of work.
The here and now.
And they go to where the work is, which is a typical story. You go to where the work is, and you will work, and you will get paid for what that work means. You don't worry about whether it's a union job or not. You don't belong to the union. You don't care if you're being a scab or not. You just need a job. And what those scabs don't understand is that at some point in time, management can let you go. Management can pay you less.
And they will.
Management will say, sorry, but we thought we needed you for a month, but you're only here for 2 weeks. Those kind of examples. So,
as I've told people, if you're going to go scab against this guy, the guy who's hiring you thinks you're a scab too.
Yeah.
And when as quickly as they can get rid of you down the road, you will go
exactly,
as well.
Exactly.
So let me ask you, we've seen, I've had a number of conversations around, the idea that Arizona has no labor history. As I'm finding out, a very rich, vibrant history. What happened?
I think historians have a great responsibility to write their labor history and their experiences as well as those experiences of their family members or persons they know. And Arizona State University does not have a labor history program. That's part of an answer right there. That could be why historians at Arizona State University may not always have written the labor history of Arizona.
So it's something deliberate, because, you know, as I've been looking across
the country. I don't
know
if it's deliberate. I think it's just what happened, as opposed to the University of Arizona in Tucson. There have been historians who have studied and have written a labor history of the state, and they're looking at a different perspective. We're looking at labor. We're looking at major copper companies in the state of Arizona. Phelps Dodge, for many years, always gave scholarships to high school students to go to the University of Arizona to go to school. Arizona State University did not do that. Northern Arizona University did not do that in terms of sending their students to a specific a copper mining industry, that's what I meant, I'm talking about here,
different.
To go to a university to study their industry. So Arizona State University started to make a little effort in the 70s into the 80s to establish a program where Jay McBride, for example, labor historian who was hired as a part-time teacher to come in and teach labor history, made a big effort in trying to get students involved in writing their labor history of their state and looking at mining, copper mining. So if we're looking at anyone who's writing about labor, we do have historians in the state who have written about their labor history of the state. You have Jim McBride. You have, of course, Jim Burkett. You have Jim Foster. Interesting.
They're all Jims, huh?
Jims.
Exactly. I have made an effort, and others have been writing about the farm workers, another group of workers who have made attempts to unionize. So all of that labor history is there. Now you need the next step. Let's teach it.
Right, absolutely. And that's just not Arizona. That's across the country.
Yeah, let's bring it into the classroom.
Can we back up? You came from one of these copper mining towns, yes?
Yes, I did. I am born and raised in Globe, Arizona. My father was a laborer, supported his local 586, originally called the International Union of Mine, Mill, and Smelter Workers, now Mine Mill. And then, of course, he worked for the Inspiration Copper Company for 42 years. So those of us who come from mining towns, those of us who are Mexican Americans who grow up with that, having a labor consciousness and understanding what it means to strike or going through a strike as a family and experiencing what that means, all of us who come from mining towns, regardless of our ethnicity, our nationalities, we all experience that. If your father, a Mexican American, African American, Anglo American, is on strike, my dad's on strike, we're the same. We're not any different. We're going through this experience the same.
So when you talk about writing our history and teaching our history, you literally mean yours. And not you as a person, but the people are still alive who could write this.
That's correct. I come from a different generation from the 60s, and coming to school, taking a class at Arizona State University talking about labor history, and knowing what I grew up with, and all of my friends coming to school here as well, becoming involved in the farm workers movement, having already had that labor experience in their background, coming from the copper towns, Globe, Miami, Superior, Hayden, Winkleman, Clifton, Morenci, and so forth. We already have that labor consciousness, and we want to write about our history, or we want to talk about it, or we come down to the universities and organize into student organizations, or we organize and help the farm workers movement, because that was coming of age for us in the 60s, this Arizona Farm Worker Movement, or United Farm Worker Organizing Committee Movement, or the United Farm Workers Movement, because it was Cesar Chavez who really made us aware of the importance of helping the working class organize.
So, you know, as you have this education in your home, because I truly believe the best mm-hmm. education you're going to get is in your home.
It's, yes.
You know, my grandparents handed this down to me because it made their lives better. And that, you know, we can teach things in school, but it's that personal experience.
Well, the union
is important.
The union made our life better because my father was able to work for a fair wage.
Right.
And his local had to go through many strikes to be able to have an agent, of course, bargain a contract where they could have the kinds of things that made life a little bit easier.
So let me ask you this then, because, you know, I've seen and I've talked to so many people over the years who have that shared experience that we both have that, you know, grandparents and parents were on strike and they fought for better wages, conditions, all of that. And yet they've turned around and go, well, you know, that's something that was back then. We don't need that anymore.
I think what's happened in terms of copper mining, and I'm only going to speak to that industry, when that 1983-84-85 strike occurred that Phelps Dodge led against copper, the copper miners in Clifton Morenci in that particular area, that really created, that began the downfall of unionism in the copper industry, because Phelps Dodge broke the back of unionism at that time.
And you can I'll thank Ronald Reagan for that.
And Ronald Reagan. And we didn't have a governor to support us. Bruce Babbitt, our state governor, was in the pockets of Phelps Dodge.
Right.
Phelps Dodge funded his exploratory experience when he thought he was going to run for the presidency. He needed money to find out whether he'd be a good candidate for the Democratic Party.
And he wasn't.
Phelps Dodge funded that. Phelps Dodge also gave him money, a great big loan, to buy property in Phoenix that was for sale that Phelps Dodge could use to negotiate real estate dealings with the governor, Bruce Babbitt. What was for sale was that rich property that now, after the Phoenix Indian School property was gone, that left a lot of that prime land in Central Phoenix to be open for development and real estate. There's Bruce Babbitt buying a lot of that property. Phelps Dodge gives him that money. So there's a reason why today, in 2013, even though this Phelps Dodge strike occurred in 1983, why in the mining towns, Bruce Babbitt is known as Bruce Gabbitt.
Very apropos. And you know, you go back to that time frame, you know, that early 80s, early to mid 80s, not just the Phelps Dodge, but you know, the Pittstons and you know, all across the country, all
That's
of the
right.
different strikes that went on because people were being the wages were being taken back.
Well,
these companies felt
the 1983 strike is very important. If you look at the work of Jonathan Rosenblum, his book Copper Crucible, he spells out in his book exactly how Phelps Dodge decided this time to break the union through their think tank, their business leaders, their entrepreneurs, their major Republican Party
sure.
defenders and members of the Conservative Party or the conservative right-wing party or attitudes who helped Phelps Dodge bust the union, because we're talking about business here. We're talking about making
money. Lots of it.
Exactly.
And you go back to the Lewis Powell memo, the famous.
That too.
You know, back to the 71 when a future
That's
Supreme
true.
Court justice is saying, you know, this is how we grab control of the country, and it's starting
money.
Think tanks, and it's funding education programs so we can get our thoughts
mm-hmm.
into the schools and professors and books and all mm-hmm. of this stuff to where if you want to learn about labor education, we'll be more than happy to tell you about it.
Well, thank goodness we still have historians who are writing about the labor history of Arizona now, who are just starting to think about all of this that happened in 1983, 84, 85, because look at the state of the economy in Arizona.
Yeah.
It's terrible.
Yeah.
We're really, really at a center point here where things are going to have to happen. Oh, sure. The real estate business is improving. Housing prices are fair now. You can question all of that. But when we're looking at the working class and the workers and the people who are looking for fair wages, where are they? What are they having a better life? Are they working for a good wage? Or what's happening to the students who are trying to go to school? Where is their financial aid? All of these things that
there's
really...
There's financial aid, there's well-backed government loans that they get to have.
Well, financial aid money may not keep up with the tuition.
He's being so sarcastic yeah. and facetious, and I just need to throw that out for the people who heard that and thought it might have meant it.
All the wonderful loans.
What happened with George W. Bush, to quote a friend of mine, George W. Bush was ruthless because he put a banker between a child and an education. And the fact that you cannot get what is... a bare minimum of a decent education anymore without getting into such debt that you'll never be able to afford another life's challenge like a house or anything else is what's happened now to this current generation. And that is so awful. And just to go for 1 minute, what appears to be off the track, but I don't think so, is I just want to ask you, I drove by the Arizona State University Walmart.
What is up with that?
Yeah, what's with all Walmart on campus?
I think it's happening in universities everywhere where there is now a link between the university and enterprises that will donate money to keep the universities going. In the state of Arizona, the state legislature has not been very good or very willing to allow universities to have the amount of monies to develop that they did in the past, and that all goes back to the leadership of the state.
So we get to sell our children.
Yeah. Yeah.
Amazing stuff. Let's take a quick break. I want to follow up on this on the back of the break here. Stick around. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show.
Listening to The Rick Smith Show. Last summer, when enough to pay the loan, goodbye to see the plan to spring from bank or close. Come on, old friend, shipping up to auction off the land. I said, John, it's just my job, and I hope you understand.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. The People's Tour for America. We're here at Arizona State University in Tempe, Arizona. I'm sitting here with Chris Marine. She is a historian and curator emeritus of the Chicano Research Collection here at Arizona State University. Chris, thanks for taking time for us.
Certainly.
You know, in the last segment we were talking about, you know, Walmart on campus, and we were both Pat and I, I'm going, Walmart on campus.
I'm just as shocked as you are.
What?
I know the university is going through difficult times. President Crow is making an effort to reach out to bring in more enterprise that will benefit the university, mainly because the state legislature has been so stingy with its money, not just affecting Arizona State University, but the other sister universities. And so, therefore, there has to be some kind of a relationship there. Why do you think the Wells Fargo Arena is called the Wells Fargo Arena?
Money. Why is there an Einstein bagel and a
exactly.
Jimmy John's?
That's
and
right.
All of the chain,
exactly.
The chain restaurants you have. When I was in college,
There were cafeterias,
and you would go through, and they were
You'd
workers
have
who
have
had
a meal
wages.
Ticket, wouldn't you have to have a meal ticket
sure,
to be able to go eat at your cafeteria at your student union on your campus?
Absolutely.
Sure.
But you know,
now we're their meal ticket.
Yeah. I mean, you know, the money that went into that, you know, paid to help the school.
Yes.
Now what we're doing is we're seeing that being
yes.
drained away because we're. To me, it's just more of the sign of the times that we're selling our institutions away.
Well, I think what it also signals is that this melding of enterprise and education.
These have a word for that. It's called fascism.
This melding of these two, enterprise business and education, and it leaves the student in a bind because the student now can find work for Einstein bagels or work for Walmart or work for Starbucks. But what is the student getting paid? What is the wage of that student in the state of Arizona or elsewhere? What is the fair wage for students or for anyone? What is the, what is it, $9 an hour? $10 an hour?
$7.25. That's the federal minimum wage.
Exactly. Who then gets to vote for how much a minimum wage can be? You're going to fight for 2 more cents an hour every 5 years, maybe?
Yeah.
So...
But, you know, with these people working at these workers at Einstein or mm-hmm. Walmart, are they students?
They're not just students.
Oh, are they students? Is that the question?
Some that's the good question. Some are and some aren't. Students work, what, 20 hours a week?
Yeah.
What about those who work full time? How much are they getting paid? Are they getting paid differently than the students? What's the student wage? Who determines that? Is it the university who's going to fight for a student wage? I don't think so.
See, because I remember, you know, because I go back and, you know, when I saw this and we were talking during the break, I remember, you know, going to college and the woman who was serving the food on the lunch line, her kids got to go to the school because she worked there. Now, if we outsource this, that kid doesn't get that education.
I will tell you a story. This is a true story. You see this beautiful modern campus called Arizona State University. At one time, a portion of this university sat on a Mexican community called San Pablo. which ran from university to from mill to, let's say, rural, if you are familiar with
couple
the streets.
A couple of blocks.
Quite a good part of that property was San Pablo, where the Mexicans of Tempe lived. The Catholic church that you see on the corner of College and University was the first substantial building or structure in what was called Tempe, built by the Mexican Catholics. So you had all of these Mexican families living in San Pablo when public domain laws came into play and the normal school grew into a college, the college into a university, and was growing. It needed room to grow.
So eminent domain will
eminent
take your house.
Eminent domain will come in. We'll give you a fair wage for your property. We'll give you a fair wage for your home. So all of these families living in San Pablo were approached by an attorney from Arizona State University who said, we're using our power and our right legally to claim this property as ours in return for. So you have a certain amount of time to make a decision. Sooner or later, you do see all of these Mexican families leaving their homes, selling their homes, maybe not for the prices that they thought. But my point is that the university officials said to these Mexican families, don't worry, we'll take care of you. You will always have a job at Arizona State University. So what do those children do? What do the men do? What do the women do? These Mexican families then become our cafeteria workers, our landscape workers,
right?
Our kitchen help, our housing workers who clean up dorm rooms. Those kind of workers do get a job.
That's a good thing.
That's a good thing.
But they lost their house.
They lost everything, didn't they? That's typically what will happen using eminent domain. It doesn't matter if you're at Arizona State or not.
Right.
But the point is that there was a viable community of Mexican-American families and Mexican families called San Pablo, living in San Pablo, in Tempe, where there was so much racism occurring in that early period of Tempe history. The Anglo community called that area Greaserville. They called it Mexicanville. They called it all kinds of names. But during the evening and the nighttime, where were the Anglo businessmen going for a little drink? Or a little socializing, or a little Mexican music, or Mexican food, they were going to San Pablo. But don't tell anyone.
Yeah. Right. Isn't that how it always is?
Yeah. But you have also what's happening in Tempe, an intermingling of ethnic groups, Mexican-Americans intermarrying, which is very common. It's always been common. It's not something that was taboo. It's always been very common, this intermixing, this intermarrying, this interplay of cultures, which really is the story of Tempe. Back in the 1890s, there was a Mexican family, very well known, the Sotelo family, who had property. Intermarriage occurred. The children of this Sotelo family became students at the Tempe Normal School. The daughters became educated. They became teachers, and they went elsewhere to teach. So that's just one example of a Mexican family who became very much a part of Tempe's history, a Mexican Tempe family that really blended the two cultures together, which is what the story is all about here at ASU in Tempe and in Arizona, the mixing of cultures.
Now, real quickly, you talked about the normal school, and I just love a definition of that. And then secondly, I'd like to know what happened to the native populations that were here.
Very good story. We're talking about the Tempe Normal School, originally called the Arizona Territorial Normal School, a teaching school. That was really what this territorial school was about, to train teachers. So teachers were given diplomas or certificates to teach. And believe it or not, Spanish classes were also being taught so that students could be able to learn Spanish and to teach Spanish. So bilingualism was very much a part of the Tempe story here at the Tempe Normal School, at the territorial school. So that's what I'm talking about, the normal school, normal, or comes from that French word, means to teach. So So this is mainly a teaching university or teaching school. That's how it began as a normal school.
And then what happened to the native populations from here?
Native populations were sent to reservations. And I'm talking about the Apache Indian Reservation. Actually, there would have to be a containment of Native Americans in order for this part of Tempe to be developed.
Well, we stayed on Apache Boulevard, and I was irritated. You know, if somebody kicked me out and took my stuff and killed my family and burned my things and then named something after me, I'd be haunting. I'd be coming back to haunt.
Well, you have to think about the Tempe fathers who named their streets Tempe, or rather Apache. Supposedly, they were naming streets after the movers and the shakers. But the Apaches were contained in the 1880s here. They were sent to reservations. So before Tempe could be developed, they had to contain the Apaches because they were very much a presence here, as were other groups. The Fort McDowell Indian Reservation is so close to Tempe here, very much important to the development of this university as well because of its economy. You also had the Yaqui presence here. Those Native Americans who lived here now, what we call Guadalupe, right on the doorstep here of Arizona State University. Now there's a large group of Yaqui settlers in Scottsdale, which is right down the street here. So you had persons who were relocated or sent to a reservation. So that's what happened.
Now, we're here studying labor history, and you played an enormous role in that because you were a woman in the 60s who said, hey, we got to save this stuff. And how did that go? They asked for a list of things you wanted saved, and you snuck in labor? Nobody was looking, and you slipped them a little piece of paper?
I'll tell you how that happened. I was a student here at Arizona State University working in the full-time in the library. I was a typist. Working in a typing pool with a lot of other women. In 1970, a professor came to teach for the very first time and to develop what was called the American Studies Program, which was going to become what we now call an ethnic studies program. Dr. Manuel Servin, S-E-R-V-I-N, Manuel Servin, came from actually Calexico, but was trained as a historian, as a borderland scholar at USC. Became very much involved as a teacher, history teacher at high schools, junior high schools, then a university professor, then very well known for borderlands research, came to Arizona State University to develop the American Studies program, which at that time was being demanded by students. Let's have a Chicano Studies history class. Let's have a Native American Indian history class. Let's have an African American history class. And the university did all of that. They hired faculty to teach an ethnic studies component to a history program called the American Studies Program, which is all very interdisciplinary. So Dr. Servin comes in, becomes friends with the new library director, Bill Axford. Bill Axford comes in as a university librarian fresh out of Denver, 1970, has already had his brushes with the Chicano student movement leader, Rodolfo Corky Gonzalez of Denver, who has already formulated and brought together Chicano students and a Chicano student movement in Denver to demonstrate and ask for a Chicano studies program at the University of Colorado. Bill Axford, being the librarian there, already has had his encounter with these Chicano so-called militants. So when he comes to Arizona State University, he comes to a pretty calm campus. Nothing ever happens here. Then Dr. Servin comes in, already having had his experience in California, working with Cesar Chavez in a different way, comes in, is meeting the students who are beginning to take his Chicano history classes who say, hey, Dr. Servin, why don't you teach us our Chicano history? So Dr. Servin says, okay, but before I can do that, we need materials in the library. So Dr. Servin goes to meet Dr. Axford. Dr. Axford and Dr. Servin come to see me. I am the only Chicana working in the library in this typing pool who probably speaks up a little too much. And Dr. Servin says, I dare you to take my history class. I say, I dare you
to pay for it.
To pay for it. Well, we have this little banter, he and I. We start getting along pretty well. I take his Chicano history class. At that time, I was an English major. I wanted to get my degrees in English so I could teach. Boy, taking the class from that man changed my entire life and perspective like lightning struck. So I became a history major. But we had a deal, Dr. Servine and I. He really didn't know that much about the copper mining strikes and the labor unionism history of Arizona and the experience of these working class workers in the copper industry, the Italians, the Mexicans, the Serbs, all of these groups, the Irish and the English, all of these ethnic groups coming from the east to the west looking for work. They come to Arizona because they're recruited to work in the mines. They get exploited. They work for cheap wages. They fight among each other for a union against management. And they finally become winners because finally they have a union. So here they are, these workers. Dr. Servine comes in from Calexico, mainly from a farm worker background, who really doesn't know about copper mining or labor industries or strikes and all of that. So we have a deal. He teaches me what he knows. I teach him what I know. We argue. We banter. We get along just great. After a while, the students start coming in great numbers to take his Chicano history class. This is all going on at the same time when Cesar Chavez is trying to formulate the United Farm Workers in the state of Arizona with the Farm Workers Union. Students like me become part of a student organization called MASO, Mexican American Student Organization. This is where we begin to agitate the university administration to begin a Chicano studies collection in the library. This is where Dr. Servine comes in and he says, Chris, we need someone to manage and become a bibliographer for this Chicano Studies collection, and we want you to do this. Dr. Servine, I am only a clerk typist in this library. I don't know how to do these things because I'm only a typist. Don't worry about it. Dr. Axford comes to see me. Chris, how are you? Oh, Dr. Axford, how are you? I see you're having trouble with your typewriter, because I had complained. I said, yes, and it was one of those typewriters. I lied about getting this job. Did I know how to use an electric typewriter? I said, yes. I lied. I didn't. So when I had to use an electric typewriter for the first time in this job, typing cards, the old days were cards and card sets in a card catalog, and I had to learn how to type those cards, I didn't know how to use an electric typewriter. So I complained to my supervisor that something was wrong with it. Dr. Axford comes in. Chris, I hear you're having trouble using your electric typewriter. Does it need work? I said, I think so, Dr. Axford. So the whole point is that I meet Dr. Axford, who has already talked to Dr. Servine, who has they've already decided that I am now going to be the bibliographer for this Chicano Studies collection. So what is my job now? I am to hire work-study students to work with me to use these bibliographies that Dr. Servine had in his collection that showed the holdings of universities and colleges in California that had books about Mexican Americans, or Chicanos as the term was being used. So if our library here at Arizona State didn't have these books, let's order them. So me and the students were going through our holdings. You know what I mean by that? Checking against the titles of what was in the bibliographies and what we had in our library. We ordered what we didn't have. Dr. Servine was building this collection so that he could use these materials in his class for the students. Dr. Axford was building, to keep the students quiet, a Chicano Studies collection in a library. So they come to see me. We need you. You're Chicana. You're a student in this group. You're an employee of this university library. You can do this.
And your typewriter doesn't work.
And my typewriter doesn't work. I said, I will do it. So this is how we began at that time in 1969, Chicano Studies Collection, Library of Books, in a small little collection, small little section of books along the wall, probably half the size of this room where we are now, and little by little, because of Dr. Axford, because of Dr. Servine, because of the university president who supported the idea, and because of many faculty and students, the MASO students who became MECHA later, that whole student contingent of MECHA, Movimiento Estudiantil Chicanos de Aztlán, the Chicano Student Movement of the Southwest, student organizations in their college campuses calling themselves MECHA students now. And throughout the Southwest, the Chicano Student Movement, with Jorge Gonzalez, with Cesar Chavez, with Rodolfo Gutierrez, Angel Gutierrez, and others were forming this Chicano movement throughout the Southwest. Students needed books. Students needed classes in Chicano studies. Faculty needed to be hired to teach these classes. And the university here at ASU became pretty well known for what it was doing and what other universities were not doing.
So this just inspires one question for me that maybe it's just so simple it'll be answered in a word or two. If all this studying has been going on, why are people still crapping on Mexican Americans?
Because they always have been able to get away with it. The sleeping giant.
Because they can.
The sleeping giant goes to sleep. The sleeping giant gets stepped on. The sleeping giant arises. This time, the sleeping giant is no longer quiet. Because now there are more of us. There are more of us in demographic numbers. There are more of us statistically. There are more of us here in terms of a presence. And we're not like the cucaracha that you can just step on. You think the cucaracha is going to go away. There's another one right behind it. You could have the most beautiful building in Arizona, modern conveniences, air conditioning, and right in that little corner is a cucaracha.
And she can't type.
And she can't use an electric typewriter.
Well, good thing is they don't have them anymore, so you're safe now.
And the best thing about this is now Dr. Marin.
Dr. Marin, I worked my butt off. I'm not going to be shy about it. My parents sacrificed to send their kids to school. My dad was a hardworking copper miner, loved his local 586, was a very, very important part of helping his union, and along with other men, earn a fair wage for their labor in the copper industry. So my parents struggled and sacrificed for all of us, and we had to work our butt off, and it was a lot of work, but it was worth it. And so, yes, I became a professor. I taught history. I was in the classroom. I work with students. I do my research. I do my writing. But it isn't about me. See, it's not about me. It's about the work. It's about my responsibility of writing this experience and teaching it and doing the research and getting it published. And I'm just one of many.
Last question I've got for you. In looking back over your life, how is this education possible? Walk me through that. Because, I look at students today saddled with massive amounts of debt as states and the federal government have walked away
financial
from
aid,
funding higher education.
Financial aid was important. My dad was a miner. Miner's pay didn't go very far with six children in the family. If it hadn't have been for my older brothers, and that's the whole history of our Mexican culture, extended families help each other. My brothers helped me in school. See, my brothers were able to go to college because they were in sports. They were athletes. They went to school on athletic scholarships, my brothers. My brother Ben Marine came here to Arizona State Teachers College on a track and field scholarship. My brother Tom, his twin, went to Arizona State College in Flagstaff, now NAU, on a track scholarship. So when it was time for me to come to school, and there was no doubt because my parents were sure that I was going to come to school, Tempe was a lot closer to Globe, Arizona, than Flagstaff was to Globe, Arizona. So I'm coming to Arizona State Teachers College or Arizona State College. My brother is already here. My brother helped me get started. So all I got was a measly tuition at that time was $100, if I recall, back in 1961.
$100.
I think that was tuition in 1961 for me to get started. I worked during the summer to get that pay. Benny helped me, my brother Ben. That was it. And so it was up to me to get going. Well, at that time, many persons from Globe and Miami already worked here on this campus as laborers. There was a gentleman who worked at the cafeteria who said, "Chris, I talked to your dad. Your dad told me you were here. Your dad said you needed a job." I didn't want to work. I already worked during the summer. I thought I had enough money. He says, come over here to the cafeteria. I'll put you to work. Your dad said you needed a job. So I got a job at the cafeteria. I worked everywhere I could for Saga Food Services. I did cafeteria. I did line work. I did catering. I didn't care what I did. So I was getting paid. So that's how I started working as a student, working on campus. But then I also help through financial aid, through the War and Poverty Programs, LBJ. Financial aid money came to the War on Poverty for students to be able to earn money. You had to meet the criteria. So that meant my going to the financial aid office with my parents' paperwork showing their pay. I had to qualify for financial aid to come in as work study. So I got work study money, and I got some additional money from working on campus, so that's how it started. Then later, working as a full-time employee at the university because I couldn't afford to go to school, I took advantage of the tuition waiver that the state offered all of its state employees, a tuition waiver to go to school. So that's how I became a tuition waiver student. And I was a tuition waiver student for many years, many years. I got my BA, my MA, and my PhD as a tuition waiver student.
What a great investment. If we could just look at education as an investment again.
That, yeah. There's no profit in that for them.
There is.
Not for them.
There is. My dad went GI Bill. GI Bill, he was a butcher. Then he became a medical director. Can you imagine the difference in income tax he paid? Or he used to pay before they didn't make differences in income tax. Before the rich stopped paying.
Good point. Chris, we appreciate you taking time for us.
Thank you for inviting me to participate.
I
appreciate
you so much.
It very much. You're welcome.
Got to take a quick break. Right back on the People's Tour for America. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Covering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith. The man who sends the investor class diving for their tax shelters. Rick Smith.
At every trough you stop to feed. With your arrogance, your ignorance, and greed.
Now here come the cuts and redundancy. Through the absolute indifference, the avarice, incompetence, your arrogance, your ignorance, your greed. At least we're all in it together.
And welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. The People's Tour for America. Another day on the road, finding our way out of Arizona. Really interesting stories we've come across while in Arizona. And I got to be honest, you know, in talking with Chris Marien there, lots I didn't know about, lots for me to go back and to explore. And, you know, as I've been saying on this tour, you know, what we're learning is just the beginning. You know, as we turn around, as we head back towards home in the next couple of days, These will be ideas, these will be topics, these will be subjects we bring up in the future, and we're going to go back and revisit the people we've talked to once we have a little bit more information. And I'm excited about the rest of the tour. And of course, if you've missed any portion of the tour, the People's Tour for America.com, pictures of where we've been, all the interviews, all the stuff right there. For your convenience at the website, you can interact with the program anytime. You can email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. You can follow us on Twitter, like us at Facebook. All really great ways to interact with the program. Tomorrow we're going to be in Las Vegas talking to a number of labor unions there. AFSCME's going to be there. We're going to talk to some culinary workers. And more discovery, more opportunity to find out what's going on as we move across the country. Hope you've enjoyed our coverage thus far. And we'll see you back here tomorrow.
America better. Email Rick.
Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com or interact with us anytime at TheRickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where we're...
Welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is The Rick Smith Show from the road, the People's Tour for America, and traveling across country doing our labor history tour. You know, I got to tell you, Pat, before we get into the labor history stuff, got to take a break and go back to the insanity that is going on right now in the State House in Pennsylvania. Just absolutely mind-blowing. We leave the state, everything goes crazy.
Okay, so it's the fact that our watchful eye is missing?
Evidently. I mean, you leave and all of a sudden, all of the insanity that we've been talking about for the last at least a year, now bubbling to a head, all of it right there on the surface. And in the next couple of days, the next week, it'll be interesting to see what kind of things pop up.
Well, I think tomorrow's vote, or it could come to a vote tomorrow, the liquor store, the throwing away of 5,000 jobs, just completely pitching it, and that's tomorrow.
Oh, but they'll find jobs, Pat. Come on. The private sector will bring them in gainful employment. I mean, you know, from the very beginning of this latest assault on the asset known as the wine and spirit shops in Pennsylvania, from the very beginning, the Corbett administration, Terzai, all of the Republicans who keep pushing this like some fetish. I mean, it's the privatization fetish that these guys have. Every step of the way, it's been one lie, one fabrication, one myth after another. And when you finally break down the lie, the fabrication, the myth, they come up with another one. You know, I remember right when this all started, right at the very beginning, we were one of the first programs on the air to be talking about it, saying, look, they're going to come for this asset, they're going to take it away, and they're going to hand it over to their campaign buddies. What they tell us? Oh, we're going to get $2 billion. Almost immediately, Pat, almost immediately, the $2 million number was debunked. No one, not even the Tinky Tank over at the Commonwealth Foundation, not even they could justify where they pulled the $2 billion number out of. I have an idea where they pulled it out of.
I was going to say, probably it smelled bad. Nobody really wanted to get too close to it.
So immediately they jump off the $2 billion number. Then they go, well, we can justify $1.7 billion. And after a couple of months, well, you know, maybe not so much. And then it was $1.5 billion. And then it was $1 billion. Then it was $500 million. And you go, well, wait a second. We get $500 million a year from it every year. Why would I want to sell it? Why do I want to sell the Golden Goose?
For a one-time amount of $500 million.
Exactly.
Because so, their buddies will make that money from now on.
Well, I mean, that's the underlying theme in all this. But it's the lies, it's the fabrications, it's all of the BS they keep throwing at us. And then when all of the money numbers were debunked, it wasn't about the money anymore. It was about core function of government. And I love this one because, you know, government shouldn't be in the business of liquor sales. And I go, well, I'm going to be honest. I think, having grown up in a state where beer was everywhere, where you could get 42-proof liquor literally everywhere, yeah, I think government should have a role.
You know, I don't really care about sins. I don't care about sin regulation. I'm a libertarian when it comes to that stuff. I think it all ought to be legalized, prostitution, everything. And then we can regulate it and have some control over people, whether or not they're making other people sick.
Let me stop you there then. So then regulate it, because that's where I'm at. So you say you're a pretty big libertarian. Let's open it up. But regulate it? Explain that a little.
Well, what I'm saying, well, that was prostitution. If we legalized prostitution, then we would have women being checked and they'd be tested for illnesses. But in the case of this, it's just throwing money away, money
yep.
that we're going to have to raise taxes to replace.
Oh, we're not going to raise taxes.
Yeah, we're just going to...
We're going to cut funding for education.
What is it? We're going to make a government so small that we can drown it in the bathtub? Yeah, no, it's ridiculous. It's it is necessary to pay for certain things that an adequate and responsible government made up of the people should be delivering. We're riding on a road right now, driving down a road. The roads need to be there. The roads have lovely little reflectors on them. They need to be there. The bridge is, you know, a tanker blows up and burns up a bridge and somebody's got to replace it. And there are things that the government is uniquely suited to, and it has to be paid for.
And that's what the Republicans are saying. Let's sell the liquor stores and get whatever pennies we can get for it, and we'll put it in the roads.
Yeah, no, that's idiotic, because what you're doing is you're giving up. What is that thing? I mean, what they're talking about is trading the cow for the six little beanstalk beans. You know, here's the cow. We got milk for a lifetime, but no, we're going to take these six little beans and plant them in the magic privatization garden, and everything will be okay. Because then it's a great big beanstalk, and we go up there and we get the goose that laid the golden egg from the privatization garden. It's just absolutely stupid. And the thing that drives me nuts is, why aren't the voters keyed into this?
Well, I think it's all of the misinformation. I mean, I've talked to numerous people who've said, well, you know, if we can get $2 billion for it, that sounds like a pretty good idea. And then you explain to them, well, that's only 4 years worth of what we're bringing in if we just leave it the hell alone.
Yeah. Well, but still, why don't they get that? I mean, it doesn't make any sense to me. Why would I, look at it as a business. Why would I give up my means of income? Why would I do that? That doesn't make any sense. It might make sense if I were terminally ill, and that's really what they're hoping. They're hoping government is terminally ill, and they can be done with government. And by the way, never vote for someone who doesn't believe in the job you're electing them to. If someone says, I'm going to get rid of government, and then they want to be put in the government,
Run. Don't
vote for them. Yeah, run. Run yourself. Run for office.
Yeah, I mean, you know, that's, it would be like me going, I've got a brain tumor, and I'm going to go to a doctor who doesn't believe in knives.
Yeah.
I'm going to go to a doctor who doesn't believe in surgery. I'm sorry.
Or any
medicine.
Other procedure, right.
We're going to put our hand on your head, and we'll see if that helps.
Faith healing. That's what this is about. Government faith healing.
There's a lot to that. I mean, it's this whole blind faith belief in this mythical free market. And you talked about the jobs there for a second. 5,000 good-paying, family-sustaining, community-sustaining jobs will be eviscerated, will be gone, wiped out. And where will those people go? Oh, the private sector will get them jobs, the right tells us. Well, that's completely false, because we know where liquor will end up. It's going to end up on the Walmart shelves. It's going to end up on just another product, an impulse item next to the Tic Tacs.
I got to tell you, I come from a state where Walmart sells booze. And just like everything else Walmart sells, it's crap. So on top of the fact that, you know, you're going to have it all over the Walmart, you're going to have boxed wine and the cheapest beer you ever saw, Coors crap.
But Pat, I'm told that the free market will bring me more choices at better prices.
Oh, no, I'm telling you, I shudder when the only place you can shop is Walmart for alcohol. So you're having a dinner party, and you're like, oh, my God, I forgot to get something. And you walk into Walmart, which I don't do because they sell crap. They don't even have bottled wine. They have boxed wine, and every you-know-what watery, icky beer that they sell. And those are your choices. You don't get... I mean, I love the Pennsylvania liquor stores. You don't drink. I drink. And
I drink occasionally.
Well, I love going into the Pennsylvania liquor stores because there's somebody there who knows what... I mean, I'll go in and say, you know, I'm making a piece of fish, and I really want something that's going to not be, you know, too overpowering. And, you know, and they make recommendations, too. They know if you're buying a bottle of wine, you know whether or not it's going to be gross, you know? And you have a wide array of prices to choose from, and they have boxed wine.
So you're saying the guy standing behind the counter at the local drug mart or the local drug world isn't going to be able to give you those well-informed, highly educated choices there?
Not going to happen.
The pharmacist at Rite Aid in Maine does not help you select your beverage. Believe it or not, they do your pharmaceuticals. You're on your own when you go into Rite Aid on whether or not you're going to get Coors Light or Miller Lite.
See, I would think that even the people who are in charge of the pharmaceuticals would be perfectly suited for the alcohol.
That maybe they are, but guess what? They're not allowed to. Because they're busy doing your pharmaceuticals. They're busy making sure that you don't get the wrong medicine and drop dead, which is the role of a drugstore, by the way.
See, but here's my problem with all this, and we've spent a couple of minutes talking about this, the rational, sane, logical reasons why this is a bad idea. And for me, it comes down to we have spent now 2 entire years talking about this. 2 entire legislative sessions, we've been focused on this, the shiny thing, the thing that really, I don't know anybody who thinks, and any normal person, any person who works for a living, who has to get to work on the crummy roads, has to get to try and find a job when they're not there. I don't know that this is a problem for 9/10 of the people in our state. What it tells me is all of this focus, all of this effort, all of this push to steal this asset tells me that they've got nothing else to do.
No, that's not what it tells you. What it tells you is there's a cash cow called the liquor industry, and right now, the state of Pennsylvania is in control of who gets the cash out of the cow, and about 10 friends of highly placed legislators and the governor want the cash cow. It's not that we don't have anything else to do. It's that, you know, there's a beautiful woman in the high school, and you asked her out, and she turned you down, and you asked her out again, and she turned you down. Guess what? You're coming back to school in December, you're asking her out again. Can't learn your lesson because you're absolutely convinced you have to have her. It's pathetic.
On a certain level, you know, given your scenario, I give someone credit for at least trying, because you know maybe you got a shot, and maybe it's going to be good
That's
for somebody.
That's what they're thinking. You know
what? This is no good for us. It's no good for anybody.
But you're going to wear the voter down, and you're going to wear the legislators down. You're going to wear them down. And you're going to keep asking, and finally you're going to say, oh, well, what could be wrong with it? They've been after us for 5 years now. Let's just let them have it.
But here's my problem with this. And, you know, maybe I misstated it a second ago. Isn't there anything else that needs to be done in our state? Aren't there any bridges, any roads? Isn't there aren't there any projects that we could be focused on that would improve the lives of people instead of, well, ripping us off?
Oh, yeah.
And why aren't we doing them? And why aren't people screaming in the streets that things aren't getting done? Is it that we've just gotten beaten down and we've gotten to the point where people just throw up their hands and go, they're not going to do anything anyway?
I honest to God don't know. First of all, I don't know why people vote the way they vote. I don't know why Governor Corbett's governor. I don't know why 5 Republican legislators ran unopposed last time. I don't know. And then I don't understand. I mean, obviously, they've got their dogma. They've got their talking points. And their talking points say, screw the poor. Screw the people with their hand out. Yeah. And, you know, it doesn't even matter that the people they're talking about, for the most part, are children. You know, I mean.
Well, they don't vote.
No, they don't vote. But these, any one of these guys, they see a tin can on the side of a Sheetz counter with some little kid's face on it, and he has a brain tumor. Oh, yeah, they'll dig deep down and they'll get that extra $1.37. All that $1.37 will go right in that can because they're such good people who care so much about children. But sick children, healthy children, all of them who've got poor parents, screw them. You know? And so I don't understand. I don't understand. And so the greed, all I can think of is when we were in Arkansas and I watched that video about the kids that went to Central High School, and one of the black kids, the 9 black kids that was, you know, they had to force the school to let these black kids in. One of the 9 kids says it's easier to organize hatred. It's easier to organize hatred than it is to organize love. It's easier to organize someone to say no than it is someone to say, sure, let's give it a try.
It's always easier to be against something. But couldn't you make that argument against selling the wine and spirit shop? Wouldn't you? You know, you're just against it because it's your ideology. You know, you're not willing to try.
My ideology is bring in money into the state and do good things.
But we've figured out, we've devised a scheme where it's potentially possible under every perfect scenario that we would make at least the same amount, if not a penny more.
Thank you, Michelle Bachman. You know, honest to God, I don't know why we have to be stupid just because we don't know that somebody else has already been stupid.
Washington State.
Right. Just look to other states. Michelle Bachman, oh, we don't need a minimum wage. Let's give that a try. Why don't you just visit Haiti? They're giving it a try right now, and you can see what it looks like. You know, I mean, it's not like Pennsylvania is going to be the first state to privatize alcohol. And as I said, I drink alcoholic beverages. I lived for many years in the state of Maine where you could go and purchase alcoholic beverages anywhere, anytime, except midnight until 8 a.m. on Sunday morning. Other than that, any place, anytime.
Wow.
24 hours a day. If a place was open, you could buy alcohol.
See, when I was in Cleveland, you used to be able to go through. They had these drive-through set up. I don't know if they had them in Maine. But they had these barns, like the one in Carlisle, that you could drive through and you could pick up. But you used to be able to buy a single can of cold beer. They'd pull it right out of the refrigerator for you, give you a single can. And it's sometimes, I think they'd even open it for you.
That's the way it is in Florida. Yeah, well, I mean, and as long as it's for a passenger in your car, right? You're all set.
What if you're driving by yourself?
Yeah.
I guess that's one of those, stop touching me!
But that's the other thing, is it's not illegal to drink and drive. It's illegal to drink too much and drive. And so that's the other slippery slope that people get on, is then after they've had a beer or two, they have to make the decision what's too much.
I think they do have open container laws where you can't have an open container in Pennsylvania.
Well, then I guess that will eliminate someone driving through and having an open container handed to them.
But they do sell those. They do sell those cute little can holder things.
The koozies?
Yes.
I bought a couple of koozies.
I know you did while we were in West.
In West, yeah. Pray for West, it said on it, and I had to have those.
But, you know, I look at this, and I look at the whole budget fight and all of the what's going on in Harrisburg. And I just, you know, as we're out here on the road and, you know, we're exploring and discovering the history of workers across the country, you know, I just had to take some time and look back because, you know, I saw they want any transportation bill money. And now the governor has come up with, in his State of the State speech, said $1.8 billion over the next 5 years. On a need that even his transportation commission said is far exceeds that number. Senate Republicans want $2.5 billion a year for the next couple of years. House Republicans are saying, well, we're not doing anything until you get rid of that prevailing wage and you steal wages from those people who are doing the work. And I look at this and I go, when will the rational part of the Republican Party expel the Daryl Metcalfs and the Stephen Blooms and the other radicals that are inhibiting the House GOP?
I don't think they're going to. And I think that's something that the average voter needs to start getting their hands around. Why the United States wants a two-party system, I'll never understand. But why they want the two parties to be the Democrats and Republicans, I find even more remarkable. You know, I mean, just jettison the Republican Party. And a
good portion of the Democratic Party.
Well, no, because then the Democrats will be the Republican Party. Because they're so conservative right now, Democrats are Republicans.
Okay, there you go.
Okay, Republicans are fascists.
The president himself, over Christmas, said 20 years ago he'd have been a Republican. So I see your point.
Yeah. So, and the rank-and-file Republicans, they're not the fascists. It's their leadership. So they can all become Democrats because the Democrats are Republicans. And then let's find a party of the left. Let's find a progressive, intelligent party. I happen to have one that I'm rather fond of. But let's find an right now, the Socialist Party is launching a letter-writing campaign to have student loan debt forgiven. Okay, that's something a political party should be doing. By the way, it's something a political party in power should be doing. But these two conservative political parties we have aren't going to do that. So we've got a third party launching a letter writing campaign. You can go to their website on Facebook. You can check it out. You don't have to become a social member of the Socialist Party to write a letter to your congressman. In fact, you should write a letter to your congressman every week, whether you need it or not. You know, if the only place you have to think is the bathroom, write it on toilet paper.
That'd be a good thing.
Yeah, send it to your congressman.
Should you use it first or not?
I would say no.
Okay.
I would say no. But write to your congressman and say, you want to stimulate the economy? Take the anvil off of children's necks, young people's necks. Let them have what they should have had all along, which is a decent education that didn't bankrupt them, you know? And just do it. And it's brilliant. I mean, the way it's done now is they bankrupt children, young people. Even if they can find a job, they can't afford to pay their student loans. But because of the income tax deduction, we'll just suck all their money out of them anyway. They'll garnish their refund every year
for life. And yeah, I gotta find a gig like that. I gotta find a money making venture where I've got the keys to the kingdom, and the only way you get through that door is by paying me. And if you don't pay me, I will have someone hound you till the day you die.
Sounds like you want to privatize liquor.
Ooh, there you go. Let's take a quick break. When we come back, I want to talk a little bit more about the transportation piece of the budget. Also, some of the other insanity our governor has put forth. Not even setting up an exchange, but he's already saying what the exchanges will and will not have. Quick break, right back from the road. The People's Tour for America. Stick around, we're right back.
Exposing that free trade is never free. The Rick Smith Show.
We took a concerted effort to go out and find women who had backgrounds that could be qualified to become members of our cabinet. I went to a number of women's groups and said, can you help us find folks? And they brought us whole binders full of women.
Binders, Pat. Binders full of women.
You
were up in Massachusetts for a while. Were you in one of those binders by any chance?
Oh, man. I remember Mitt Romney getting elected. That was crazy. You know, and he was left of Obama by a lot when he was a Republican governor from Massachusetts.
Oh, yeah. What happened to Mittens? I mean,
what happened to Mittens is the same thing that happened to John McCain. You've got to get the stink of a... kind of smell a skunk right now, actually, while we're driving. But you got to get the stink of these neocons all over you. They won't support you for...
We are in Arizona.
Maybe it's not a skunk.
Maybe not.
Maybe it's just the governor.
Maybe.
What's her name?
Jan Brewer.
Yeah, see? That's it. Smelling some Brewer.
Ooh.
All right, so anyway... you've got to embrace the rabid neocon, or you don't get, you know, what you need to run for office. So that's pretty straightforward and direct and simple. And so Mitt Romney, first of all, I don't think it was that big a stretch for him to think of the other guys as the takers and himself as the maker. I mean, that's why he did Bain Capital. You know, that's why he destroyed businesses and sucked the money out of them.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's the ultimate vampirism. You've got to kill the host. You suck on the host until the host dies. And, move on to a new host. And so that's what he did at Bain Capital, and now it's pretty much what he does in...
Back
know,
to it.
Yeah.
But here's the thing. I saw this story the other day that the governor signed a piece of legislation stating that Pennsylvania would, in whatever private plans that come up will no longer be allowed to cover abortion services. And I'm going, well, wait a second. We don't have the exchange set up. We haven't done really anything to get ready for the Affordable Care Act. In fact, he's done everything he can possibly do to obstruct, delay, destroy, whatever. But now he's making it that even in the things he hasn't had any hand in, well, we're gonna deny women this coverage, even if it's a completely private plan from a private company to a private citizen. What happened to the Republican Party?
Well,